Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What'd you have for dinner? Yeah, nice late dinner. What'd you have?
What did we have? I had like a chicken, spicy chicken sandwich from this burger place. I'm in Saugerties now.
Oh, you're up there. Okay. Surprised you're not eating kale. Isn't that what people eat up there?
I eat kale, dude. I love kale.
I'm into kale.
I'll eat me some kale.
I got a shirt. Speaking of Saugerties, I think it's from the Garden of Eden in Woodstock, which is that like healthy.
Yeah.
Healthy vegan vegetarian cafe there. And on the back of it, it's like a fist holding up a bunch of kale and it says kale power. And I know it's corny, but I wear that shirt sometimes in a certain environment to like troll people. You know, it's one of the upsides to just being a big human being
right. With
a mustache and long hair is like, I don't know. Most people don't say shit to me, you know? Right. And I like going to places where you wouldn't wear a Kale Power shirt and wear a Kale Power shirt and just watch people give me the side eye and then I like give it back. I'm like, what? Motherfucker, you got something to say about kale? Fuck out of here with that, you know? Like if I just get all gangster about it. I have another thing I've been doing too. You'll enjoy this. It's really out of character. I kind of enjoy wearing the face masks because you can make faces at people without them knowing, you know. I make all sorts of weird motions with my mouth now and stuff at people to amuse myself. And I've taken on a new one, which is if some, you know, because now it's becoming new. If I had a passerby in the street I was trying to look friendly to, I used to give this like passive grin.
Right.
You know, like I notice you, hello.
Yeah.
And you can't do that anymore. So now I'm starting to do like a little hand.
Right.
You know, like a hi, I see you. Right. Just giving him a little hand. But I've taken a couple times and it's pretty useful. I'll see someone and we'll make eye contact. I've just been going, howdy. Like giving up a big, like deep voice, like surly
right.
howdy
right.
in the middle of the city. And just looking like me, I don't know. I just really enjoy the confusion that it seems to give to people for a couple seconds. They're like, what, did he mean it? Is he Southern? What's happening? And then they're gone. And then I just chuckle
I have like all these little old ladies in my building that I've always tried to be super friendly to because they're all about to kick off. And
nice. I mean, real nice.
I lost my favorite one a couple weeks ago. She was an old stripper from like way back in the day.
Really?
And I always had it in the back of my mind that at some point like I'd interview her for a podcast, you know?
Sure. Right.
And I never did, and that's one of those, you know, one of those lessons. Mm. Like seize the moment. Anyway, always. I've realized since COVID, I kinda had this realization like fairly recently that with the mask on, I'm often trying to like smile even broader when I see them. And I'm wondering if like they see this guy, like I haven't had a haircut in a while. Like I've been wearing a hat a lot. Like they may not even recognize me and I'm just glaring at them and they can't tell if I'm smiling or
no.
It's because a few of them have given me funny looks and I thought, maybe I look really creepy.
I mean, I'd have to assume if you're smiling even more and broader, it's got to shrink your eyes a little.
Yeah, yeah.
So you probably look like you got like tiny little eyes.
Like a piercing glare I'm giving
them. Yeah. They don't trust it. Oh. They're like, someone looked at me like that in the 40s and it didn't go well. You're flashing them back to like something awful. Should stop doing that.
Just ignore
You know me. What I was listening to today, Brad? I was playing drums to some Queen.
My kids are so big on Queen right now, dude.
I'm listening, you know, it's an overlooked song just because, like, you know, it gets played in like sports stadiums and.
But We Will Rock You?
No, that one's actually cheesy. And, you know, it's at the end of Revenge of the Nerds, but We Are the Champions.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's such an epic opus of a song.
Yeah.
And all day in my head, I've been singing, it's been no bed of roses, no pleasure cruise. I consider it a challenge before the whole human race, and I ain't gonna lose. I'm like, holy shit.
It's epic,
who
dude.
Can spit hot fire like that? Like,
oh,
Freddie
yeah.
Mercury. Verse 2 of We Are the Champions is hot fire.
Yeah, yeah.
Come on.
Oh,
like,
absolutely.
Who does that? Who could even get away with that these days?
And fucking epic. Project the way that guy projected, too.
My goodness. So impressive. It's like every time I dig back into the Queen catalog, I just find something else that pleases me.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
How about you? Queen fan?
I am a Queen fan. And like I said, my kids have really been getting into Queen lately. They were getting into it before the movie, and I'm not sure why, but then they saw the movie and it was like, forget about it. And just put them over the top.
Yeah. Now, speaking of kids, Joe Sib has a lot of them. I meant to ask him in the interview about his old podcast, Rad Parenting.
I know. It's funny. I meant to, because I talked to him a couple of years ago about that. When he was still doing it, he called me with like some technical questions. And yeah, I meant to bring it up too. I don't think he's doing it anymore, but you should check it out anyway. It's still available. It's an interesting podcast.
Yeah, there's some cool episodes. I really like found it cool. But it was great to have Joe on.
Oh, my God. Like, way overdue, like I said.
Yeah.
What hasn't he done? He's been very successful at everything, you know?
And he's just like a born entertainer. I even said it in the interview, too. There's like, Joe's always had this, like, natural hustling spirit to him. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Where,
it's driven by cool things. It's not driven by like the need for more or something like that. I think it's driven by his own restlessness and creativity and that. But between his last name and that kind of spirit, and then I met him, I'm like, how's this guy not from the East Coast? And then all of a sudden he's just like, bro, every morning I wake up and the sun hits me and I just jump in the pool. He's like, you should try it, bro. I remember when like we just signed to side one. And I'm like, bro, I'm homeless. What are you talking? I'm homeless and I live in New Jersey. I can't jump in my pool every morning and feel the invigorating sun of California. But I mean, he's just so awesome. It's so entertaining. I mean, I literally had like 19 more questions on my list that didn't get to just because like, all you got to do is set that guy off, and he's just telling you a tale that's amazing.
I had some really specifics that I wanted to get into him with, that like some stories I hadn't heard, but we'll do it again. We'll get him back.
Even listen to this question. You'll appreciate this. I said, I have hilarious images of what Brad Goop was like. Can you paint a picture for me a little? When did you old dogs meet? I had a question for you because I wanted to see from someone who's deeply invested in Brad Goop what his takeaway was from the time. You know, I'm fascinated by you in the 80s. It's blowing my mind.
Well, I didn't meet Joe in the 80s. I can say that.
Okay.
And it wasn't until the late, although he did bring up, I don't think in the podcast, but I talked to him for a while afterwards.
Yeah.
And he mentioned meeting me when I was in the Goops, and I don't remember that. I remember meeting him right after the Goops broke up and I was playing with the Clowns for Progress because he really liked that band.
Yeah.
So I feel bad if I'm forgetting meeting him, but he may be wrong. You know, who knows? It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, when I met him in the Clowns, we did a tour. We toured together. We were always doing shit together. They like Jack's 22 Jacks covered a Clown song. He is responsible for my two children in a way.
Wait, what?
He introduced me to my wife.
Go on.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Joseph introduced me to my wife in the basement of Coney Island High.
Really?
Yeah. And it was at a Jack show. And it was a big night because like Joey Ramone was there and there was a couple other people like that that had come out. Maybe there was somebody else playing on the bill. Maybe they were out to see the Jax. I don't know. But yeah, he introduced me to Catherine. And then I don't know if it was that night, but it was on that trip that he actually proposed to his wife Times Square.
Wow.
Yeah. So
your guys' love is interconnected.
It was a big trip, man. Big trip.
That's cool. So you owe him one, huh?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
All right. Let's get into it with Joe because this was a fun, long interview. Let's
Absolutely.
Do it.
It's going on.
Benny's buying a new house. They're trying to jack him on the roof. If he can't buy a new house because he has to buy a roof for the people he sold it to.
Joe. Find him some more royalties. Yes. Please, Joe, please.
We have to do another packaging of 59 sound, even though we've run it into the ground. How many colors of vinyl can you press? We don't know, but we can find some more.
Perfect. All right, so we need to package together right now something I can get royalties from via Side One and also something to boost me and Brad's Patreon.
So I'm in it.
Isn't it the single right here that we started writing?
Dude, we just started writing a song. Get that up on SoundCloud. Come on.
Yeah.
Is Side One ready to release this album?
It's being released right now. It's too late. It's already out. It's happening. Dude, charting.
The virtual digital world is exploding my mind.
Dude, things are happening and this is out. People are listening. There's already Instagram. There's already people hating it. It's amazing. Yeah, we have followers. Now they're not following us. That's how quick it goes now, though. That's how quick it is.
When you two were young, how long did it take to get a review back from a record? Weeks.
Right?
You had to wait for a periodical you had to send it out, wait for someone to do it, print it, let it get shipped to your house. You didn't even know if people liked your record for weeks. Now it takes what? Now it takes minutes.
Seconds.
Well, you couldn't release a record in less than 3 months. That was like, the minimum amount of time from when it was actually finished.
Well, that's still a thing. Side One would do that too.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing I remember though is I remember the first review my band Frontline ever got was in Maxim Rock and Roll. And it was one of those things where it came out and then someone would tell you, dude, you know, they talked about you in Maxim Rock and Roll Frontline and you're like, what? And then you had to go and find the issue that it was in. And by the time you got to where where issues were sold, the new one was already there. So then you had to go find the old one. Right. And by the time you read what they wrote about you, you know, Frontline played at, you know, Gilman Street and were terrible. You're like, dude, why didn't you just tell us that? I've been searching for this. And then you kind of analyze, well, dude, do they mean terrible in a good way? Or do they mean terrible in a bad? Well, maybe they mean it in a good way. Like they were terrible because they're so rad. Like,
where did you go for your Mac? Cause I know like, you know, the kids of the 90s were like, oh, we'll just go to like Barnes and Nobles. They carry some cool magazines, but like
Tower Records.
Where did you need to go for Maximum Tower?
Yeah, Tower Records, Campbell, and then a lot of times you would people sold it at shows, so there'd be like someone having it. You know, you'd go over and get it. Maximum Rock and Roll, my magazine, like my Bibles were Maximum Rock and Roll, Flipside, and Thrasher. Yeah. Those were the three that I lived by. And then what I also had was these two radio shows. Growing up in San Jose, we had this one station called KFJC that had vinyl rights on Thursday. And then Maximum Rock and Roll, I want to say, had their radio show on Wednesday night. So like Rock and Roll was kind of more the NPR-esque vibe of the way they handled playing new music and critiquing it, which was, you know, Tim Yohannan and his crew. And it was serious. But, you know, you found out about a lot of different bands. You know, that was the first place I heard The Addicts, first place I heard Peter and Test Tube Babies, all that stuff. And then on Thursday night, you had the show that came out of Los Altos Hills, which, you know, went to San Francisco, San Jose, all the suburbs. And that basically was Vinyl Rights. And that show was killer because they also let you know who was coming to town, you know, for that weekend. So it would be like Friday night, you know, so-and-so's at the On Broadway, the Mab, and then Saturday night, there's going to be a show here. So like that show I really liked. And that guy's name was Alex Morgan, and he played like everything, you know, all just, it was all over the gamut. And, but it was also, it was looser. He'd have bands on there. They would play live. So like, I was really fortunate. Those two radio shows turned me on to every single band I ever got into, probably from like 82 till, you know, like 86, 87.
And you were a little skate kid by then?
Fully. That's all dude, my dad didn't come to my high school graduation, true story, because he said, I've never seen you carry any books to and from school. You only carry your skateboard. And I said, no, I have another set of books at school. And he goes, you're lying. And I was like, you're right. Skateboarding was everything to me, man. That was the only sport I was good at because I was a super, when I was growing up, like I loved basketball. I loved football. My parents would, you know, they never would let me play football. So like, okay, that's not going to happen. And then I was really into basketball. I was really into baseball until, you know, people started throwing way faster than I was able to, you know, deal with.
Able to dodge.
Yeah. As far as basketball went, I was a short kid, you know, so I was like, all right, this isn't going to happen. And then I also didn't like the whole thing of like, I went to all the practices, did all the, you know, drills. And then when the game came, the coach wouldn't put me in. I was like the Rudy on our team. Like it, our final game in eighth grade, I'm not lying. In our final game in eighth grade, we were in the lead and there was only 45 seconds. I hadn't played a game in the entire season. And the players on the team protested. They're like, either put Joe in or we're not. You have to put him in. And the coach, he goes, I don't know. I don't want to risk it. And like, I'm like, dude, there's 30 seconds. He's like, nah, like he believed that I could ruin the whole season in 30 seconds.
Dude, this is like Rudy too. When Rudy becomes punk. like the story of him not getting into the game. It's the sequel, you know?
Yeah. They didn't let me play. And I remember, I'm not making this up. When I left, it was in Santa Cruz and I walked out of the gymnasium and I literally was like, fuck this coach's training. This is lame. And I had started skateboarding at that point and my parents were separated and I had started going to Winchester Skateboard Park on the weekends where my dad lived. And I just was like, you know what? I just made a full on hard left and I was like, you know what? I'm going fully into skateboarding. And then that just led to punk rock because the music they were playing at the skate park was the first music I'd ever heard that wasn't my parents. You know, like up until that point, I grew up on like Frank Sinatra, Jerry Vale, the Beatles, Fleetwood Mac.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, you know, when I started going to skateboard park around seventh grade, it was like, what's this? This is 999. Wow. What's that? This is the Buzzcocks. This is Black Flag.
Right.
And I was so like, it really became an obsession, like skateboarding and listening to punk rock and really kind of discovering it all at the same time. And then the whole capper to the whole entire moment in that time of my life was the best skateboarder in the world was from our hometown, Steve Caballero.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, so I literally got to, you know, watch him go from amateur to pro and, you know, be there. It's like being there living in Chicago when Jordan, you're like, oh, check out this new guy. And all of a sudden you're just watching this amazing athlete. And the thing
was he older than you? Did you go to school with him or?
No, Steve's a couple years older than me, but like not a lot, like maybe 2 years. So him being a member, he was a member at Winchester Skate Park. That was his home park. And you know, that's where Stacy, you know, would come up. Stacy Peralta would come. Right. I remember Stacy Peralta would come to, you know, watch him skate.
Oh, wow.
And you know, you just saw him growing and growing as a skateboarder and as an athlete. And then at the same point, he was my friend and, you know, still is my friend. And it was just, I always say like, I didn't really think anything different about it until I remember I went into like Safeway or something. And there was this magazine back then called Action Now. And he was on the cover of it. And that just phased me like, what? He's doing a frontside invert. And it, you know, his name and everything. And it was at our home park. And that just like wait a minute, next to Cosmopolitan, like, and like Time Magazine is my friend doing a frontside invert on the cover of a magazine. I mean, it was like seeing your best friend on television or something. Yeah, it was just so mind boggling. I could, and then at that moment I was like, wow, like he's famous. Like, and you know, you knew something like that registered big when like your parents, like even my dad was like, is that Steve Caballero? And I'm like, right, yeah. He's like, he's on the cover of a magazine, you know? You know, and it was just crazy.
And what did little Joe Sib look like? Because I'm imagining California, the 80s, little Joe Sib. Did you have the full on hair?
No. Well, like when I first started at the skateboard park, like my actual, like my whole look was bowl haircut. Mm-hmm. And my head was like way too big for my body and huge teeth. Like I hadn't grown in. Like most people have to grow into their head. Like I had to grow into my teeth. Okay. I had to grow into my face. I had to grow into my head. Like I had a head of a 40-year-old man on a 12-year-old body. And it was a weird, it was, my balance was off. And at a certain point, no one ever said anything about it. And I look back at these photos and I'm like, whoa, what is going on here? This someone had to step in and go, hey, we want you to know your head is way too big for your body. And that might be the reason why your balance is off a little bit, but you may grow into it. You may not. But I think my parents just went for like, we're going to roll the dice on this one and hope everything catches up. And thank God it did. But that was my look when I went to the skateboard park. And then, when I got into, I remember I got into high school and basically like punk rock to me at that point, I was still living with my mom and growing up in Santa Cruz, and Santa Cruz is this little beach town. And we didn't like punk rock to us was a shaved head, a pair of Vans and like pegged Levi's and a flannel. Yeah, that was like, wow, man, you're pushing the envelope. And what had happened was my mom sent me to go live with my dad when I was 15. And the first day I went to this new high school that was this huge school, like in Santa Cruz, we had a student body of like maybe 500, maybe. And then all of a sudden I had a student body of like 2,500.
In San Jose?
This is in San Jose. Okay. And I'm just like, I remember I walked in and the first thing, which is so crazy, my dad just powered me into school on a Monday, like just walks up and goes, hey, this is my son. He needs to go to school here. And I remember the principal and everyone was like, well, you know, there's paperwork. He's like, nah, he needs to start now. And I remember they go, okay. And I went in and they go, all right, you're going to go to wood shop, which basically that's like going to prison in any high school. Like it is like there's dudes sharpening things. They're making bongs. There's, you know, so I go in there and then the next period was break. So I'm sitting there and I'm like, okay, so now it's the break period. What is everyone doing? Oh, everyone's getting food over here. Okay. So I went over and I remember I got a chocolate milk and a donut and I just sat down on my skateboard and I'm sitting there. And this girl walks over and, you know, she was kind of a skinhead girl, had the bangs, shaved head, you know, a bomber jacket on. And, you know, she walks over and she's like, hey, what's your name? And I'm all, Joe Sibiondo. And she's like, really? Where are you from? I'm like, Santa Cruz. And then she goes, do you like punk rock? And that's what she said. Yeah. Do you like punk rock? And I go, yeah. And then I'll never forget this. She goes, do you want to meet other people that like punk rock?
Right. Perfect.
It was like a scene out of like an after school special, right?
Sure. Yeah.
And, I go, okay. And we walk over. And then at that time they had like a quad where like, you know, all the classrooms around it. And there was this middle area. And then of course in the middle area, they had this stage, which at some point probably was for like graduations and for like events. But at this point it had nothing like that going on. And what was on the stage in the middle of the campus was the smoking section. They put the smokers up there.
Yeah. Man.
So I walk over there and on one side, it's all people and it's all what we call dirt heads. It's all dudes in Metallica shirts with flannels, little mustaches, feathered hair and like girls in moccasins and like a Motley Crue shirt. And they're all on one side. And then on the other side are all the punks. And it's all like dudes with mohawks and skinheads and, you know, flat tops and like the rockabilly dudes. And then the goth people, like, so like it was like all of us were on this stage. And the thing that was so crazy is when I walked up, like I'd never seen real punk rockers like that. Like up until that point, I'd only seen like the Punk and Disorderly album cover where I'm like, whoa, mohawk, leather jacket, studs. Yeah, right. And when I rolled up on this stage, it was like real life. Like they were all there. And I remember seeing a dude with, you know, first dude I saw with spiky hair, you know, charged hair. And I was like, whoa. And then I'm walking around and then this girl's introducing me. Hey, this is Joe Sabiondo. I'm like, oh, nice to meet you. Nice to meet you. Ah, Joe Sabiondo. This one guy recognized me from the skate park. And then this one dude, this little dude, I'll never forget, his name's Terry Root. I'll never forget it. He rolls off on me. He has no shirt on, mohawk, leather jacket on. Like that's his vibe at high school. No shirt. Like, dude, this guy has no shirt on and it's 10 a.m. This
pioneer.
Is nuts.
A pioneer. Yeah.
Yeah. No shirt, leather jacket. Yeah. And he rolls up on me and I go, he goes, hey man, what's your name? And, I go, Joe Sabiondo. He's all, oh no way, man. You're Joe Sib. And I go, no, it's Sabiondo. He's like, nah, dude, you're Joe Sib. And I go, yes. I'm just trying to, I'm like, no, it's Sabiondo. And then he goes, nah, dude, you're Joe Sib. And then at that point, I'm just like, well, I can't argue with this guy. Yeah. Like, I don't know what he can do. He has no shirt on. Like, you don't argue with someone like that. And then I remember, like, then just people started calling me Joe Sib to the point that one time my dad answered the phone and I heard him going, there's no Joe Sib here. And I'm like, no, that's for me. And then he's like, who's Joe Sib? And I'm like, that's what they call me.
That's my name now, dude.
And I remember my dad said the best thing. He's like, oh, you got a nickname. That's great. And I'm all, yeah. And he goes, yeah, don't worry about it. They never last.
Good call, Pops. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Here I am in my 50s with Joe Sib. You know, it's like, yeah, it's
I love crazy. This story too, because it's like, it's literally, you know, your entrance into this school is what I watched in like 80s movies of a California high school. I mean, it's perfect.
It was
straight
a trip,
out
man.
Of a film.
Now I look back on it though, this really quick. And like when I tell that story or whenever I think about growing up with Stevie, you know, I always feel so lucky that I was just I felt like I was in the right place at the right time. Like punk rock hit the suburbs. And I was just right there. Like if I hadn't gone to live with my dad, I would have ended up staying in Santa Cruz, probably smoking weed and just doing nothing. And like in San Jose at that time, it's just so hard to believe. There was just so much music. So many people were putting out fanzines. So many people had a skateboard ramp. So many people were bringing bands to play. So there was like this weird thing that I just thought everyone did that. I thought, my friend Larry, he brought Social Distortion here. Of course, that's what you do. You have a friend that's a promoter. Oh, my friend Denise. Yeah. Her photos just got published in, you know, Maximum Rock and Roll or Flipside. Yeah. Cause she's a photographer. Oh, my other friend. Yeah. He started a band called The Faction. They're going on tour. Oh, wow. I'm going to watch them practice. Oh, he has a record company. I mean, that's how I learned how to start side one was from my friend Adam Baum, who started I Am Records, and he was the guitar player in The Faction. And I used to go to his house and sit into it. He had a little like a den that is, you know, their family's TV room where the band practiced and his mom let him kind of take over. And like, I just would sit there and watch him. Back then you had to call like a distributor. Hey, I made, you know, can you take 60 Faction 7 inches? And I would watch him sell them. And then I'd watch him. I remember one time I thought it was the coolest thing ever. He goes, hey man, I'm going down to pick up the new record in LA. And I thought it was so punk because they drove down in this van they had, loaded the van up with the vinyl and then drove back the same day. And I was like, I was at his house when he got there at midnight, like, dude, you want to see it was the Dark Room album. And I remember we're just sitting in his driveway and I'm like, dude, like you made this. Like it was just so mind blowing. But like that really led me to do everything that I ended up doing in my life, because it was just at that time, I didn't realize it, but it was like going to college because you just were around all these DIY kids that were just doing it themselves. And I just thought everyone did that. I just thought that was the way you're supposed to do it. I didn't know any different.
I mean, when did you realize though, you know, you've always been someone so super active in anything you do. Like when did you realize at that time that you were not just going to be a pedestrian or a bystander in that scene and you're actually going to contribute to it in so many ways? Like, did that just happen or was that something you were like kind of driven to do?
Do you mean like starting a label and managing and
like
going
and like getting into bands instead of just being a skateboard kid who watches everyone else do it? How did you get to that point, getting in it like that?
Well, I think getting into a band, I always wanted to be in a band. Like from the moment, I mean, I always joke around about it. I was the kid that would go to, say, the On Broadway or, the MAB or the Farm or any of the clubs in the Bay Area at that time. And I would go from start to finish and see all 8 bands. Like if Tales from Terror were coming to, if Tales of Terror were coming to town, I had to see them, you know, like I'd read about them. If MIA, yeah, they're from Vegas. I got to check them out. Whoa, this band named Scream's coming. Oh yeah, dude, still screaming. First band on Discord. Need to see them. Like I wanted to see every band and I would go nuts during every band if I was into them. Like if I was into the band, I was into it from, you know, start to finish. And then what ended up happening was I was so into music, I was like, I want to be in a band, you know? And like, it kind of went from like, just people were like, you know, like, dude, you should be in a band. And I kind of, I never really had thought about it, but what had happened was this kid, left a bass at my house once. He was like, dude, my brother, his brother stole something from him. He's like, so I stole his bass. Keep it here? And I was like, all right. So then I would play it at night, you know, like, oh, whoa, check this out. I had a quarter and I would just sit there and my friend came over and he's like, yeah, dude, this is how you play. I'm like, oh, really? Okay. And I started playing with his bass. And then one day I saw that kid again and he was like, oh, dude, my brother went to jail for selling acid. You can keep the bass. Okay. I was like, really? All right. You know,
that's so awesome. Does the acid bass still exist?
No, the acid bass, you know, it's funny. The acid bass was the first bass for the Swinging Udders bass player, Kevin Wickersham, when they started. I sold him the acid bass. And Kevin joined the Swinging Udders. And, but I kind of, you know,
there's
so I played
guy
bass
in jail right now who has no idea how much he contributed to the punk rock scene. You know,
dude, there's some guy that sold acid that was an entrepreneur in the wrong business in the wrong time.
Right.
His story is if he only wouldn't have went to jail, he would have kept playing bass and that his music career ended.
Yeah. It could have been Jason Newsted right there.
You never know. You never know. But yeah. So for me, I started out as a bass player. I was in my first band playing bass. And then in that band, I quickly was like, you know, writing lyrics, writing songs. And then that led to, in about 1985, I was like, I want to start, you know, I want to sing. And I joined this band called Frontline and I was the singer and I sang in that band up until the time I moved to LA. Like I was in that band until like, I would say like 86, 87, 88, 89, right around there that ended. And then at that moment, I just had this, you know, I just gotten out of college. I had nothing going on. I got a degree in communications, which is the degree you get when there's no other degree to get.
Yeah, right.
You know, and it was 90. I was oddly enough, this guy got me a job, waitering, at a comedy club called The Last Laugh in San Jose.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah. So like I was there.
Okay.
I had no interest at that time of doing comedy. That wasn't even like, I was like, I want to be in a band. And then I just at a certain point realized there was just nothing for me in San Jose. And a really close friend of mine, from San Jose that had moved to LA, he was working at Slash Records. You know, he had been down there. He hit me up one day and he just said, you know, what are you doing in San Jose? And I was like, well, and he goes, Joe, there's nothing going on there, man. And you know, if you really want to go for it, you need to come down here. And you know, for like people listening, it's hard to believe, especially now with everyone doing a mass exodus from LA and California. But like there was this, at this point, it was like all the record labels were there. Everything that was going on, you know, musically, it was either New York or, I mean, Brad, you know that, like it was like New York or LA. That's where you had to be. Like if you wanted to get a deal, if you wanted to kind of take your dream to the next level, you had to be in either one of those cities. And, you know, when I came down to LA, I moved in with this dude and he let me stay with him. And that was really like, that was my like sink or swim moment, you know, like, all right, I'm going to go for it. You know, I'm going to go down there. But like, I only knew Steve Soto and my friend Brian. That was the only two. And I didn't know that Huntington Beach wasn't near I said, yeah, I'm moving to LA. And Steve's like, dude, you don't live anywhere near me. Yeah. I'm like, really? I don't. He's like, Joe, you're like 2 hours away. Really? But I'm in LA. He's like, yeah, well, I'm not coming to visit you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was living in Hollywood and the only dude I knew was Brian Ray. And Steve Soto. And I remember it was just a, you know, full on, you know, awakening, like, oh my God. And I was in over my head. Like the first weekend I'm there, my friend Brian's like, I'm having a party, you know, so it'll be great. You know, your first weekend here. And I don't know. I'm just still dressed in the way that I dressed in San Jose, dude. Like, I got my hat on backwards. Yeah. I got my shorts, my Vans. Like, what's up?
Probably, chilling. You know, giant head.
TBH. Yeah. Giant. No, I'd grown into my head at this point. Okay. I'd grown into my head. But I'm just sitting, you know, I was there and like the first party that he has at his house, I'm like, holy shit, those are the dudes from Fishbone. What the, you know, like they roll in. And then the bass player, from Eric Avery from Jane's Addiction rolls in. I'm like, what the fuck? You know, like, and then, you know, and then later on that night, like, you know, Keith Morris or something. And I'm just like, what is, like, I was just so, I'm like, these are who you hang out with? And he's like, yeah, you know, like, these are my friends. And I was just so, I knew at that point, I was like, whoa, this is a whole different ball game right now. And I was like, I remember at a certain point thinking I was going to bail. Like I even called my mom. I'd been down there for about 3 weeks and I was like, this is, you know, I can't find a job. I'm just, you know, I'm just floundering here. And I called my mom and I went for the, like, you know, kind of like went for what, you know, you never admit, but like, yeah, it's lame. I think I'm going to bail, like trying to get her to go for, yeah, I know you should. LA's lame. And, you know, and those people down there, you're different. You're this, you're that. You'll be more successful up here. You're right. You should leave. And I totally was trying to get that moment from her. And she totally went for like, I'm going to tell you this right now. Like, if you want to come home, like, I get it. And, you know, that's cool. But I'm going to just let you know right now. I think if you come home right now, you are going to regret it for the rest of your life. Like
you
got to stay. Like just because you're not making friends, like you got to figure it out. You got to find a job. You got to be, you know, you got to be that guy that I know you can be. Like you got to, you know, you got to go for it. Like you're there. Think about it. You only got one opportunity like this in your life. You're 23. Come on. Like don't come home and end up, you know, just regretting it and talking yourself out of it. And I remember I was just like, all right. And then at that point I was like, all right, first thing I need to do is I need a new haircut. I'll never forget that. And I remember I was like, what am I doing? You know, like my hair, like it's weird because I was so used to spiking it or like I never had like regular hair. So I went to this barber and he was on Melrose. And, I remember he was the first guy that I met that was living. He was this, guy that was living with AIDS and he was this first guy that I met that was going through all the treatments. And he was like this, like probably the third person, like now I knew. And he was like, hey, what's up? You know? And I'm like, I don't know, you know, what should I do with my hair? And he's kind of looking at me. And then, he's like, what do you think about this? And I remember he had like a photo of a dude with slick back hair.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh shit. Fuck. And then I go, dude, fucking Mike Ness slicks back his hair. That could be cool.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, all of a sudden he's like, let's do it. And I'm like, all right. And then he fucking cut my hair and gave me some product. And, I remember I started slicking back my hair. And then, that was like, okay. Like it was weird because at that moment, like I was able to totally reinvent myself. Like no one knew that I was the guy that had the head that was too big for his body. No one knew that I didn't play in the basketball game. No one knew that like I was in my band in San Jose that kicked me out. Like I was totally like this new dude. And I was like, okay, I can reinvent this whole operation right now. And then that led to me kind of getting the confidence enough to like, I found a gig. I found a guy to get a room. You know, we rented this apartment. And then it was like, okay, once I had that kind of nailed down, then I was like, all right, I want to find a band. And I was, you know, once again, I was looking for a band and there was a group of guys that I was looking for a drummer and these guys called me and this guy's like, hey man, I'm a drummer. I'm like, all right. He's like, we should hook up. Like, you know, that's kind of like what you did. You know, there's like, you'd go to Guitar Center and there was this board there where people posted what they were looking for.
Right.
And I ended up going up to these people's apartment and it ended up being the three guys in Wax. And they were like, we're looking for a singer. And I was like, oh, well, I was looking for a drummer. And they're like, well, we saw your influences. And it's so funny because my influences at that point that I wrote down.
Yeah. Was this a flyer you had up?
Oh yeah, dude, full flyer.
Yeah.
What and the was bands that I put on. Like? Yeah. Oh, I'll tell you right now. It said, you know, I was looking for a drummer. And I remember the band that had just come through was one band that had just come through that I went to see. And I fucking loved them so much. First record just destroyed was the Goo Goo Dolls. I was like, oh my God, you know, the Hold Me Up record on a Roadrunner. I was just like, what they were doing was so cool.
That's kind of a punk rock record.
Oh, totally.
Dude, that record, I love that record. I got to say, and I've taken a lot of flack for it because it is the Goo Goo Dolls.
That first record is sick.
Well, it's the second record, Hold Me Up.
You're right. You're right. Yeah. The Hold Me Up is the one with the polka dots on the front. So that record.
Yeah. 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 They were trying to channel the Replacements and they just came up with like, a whole kind of other thing. But dude, that record was one of those records that I listened to. There was a part time of my life when I had broken up with a girl. I was like, I used to put that record on and listen to the whole thing and then like go, okay, what am I going to put on now? And I'd be like, oh, there's nothing else I can put on after this. And I would put it on again and listen to it like 3 times in a row.
Oh, yeah.
I get so much flack for that record, though, because it's the fucking Goo Goo Dolls.
Yeah, but the thing, you know, it's funny because there's music in your time. And Brad, like when you say breaking up with a girl, for me, it was, I had broken up with a girl that was in, you know, in San Jose. Like the way I had to leave San Jose sucked because the girl I was going out with, you know, bailed me. My band bailed me. And it was like, you know, it was just like San Jose was sending me a message like, dude, your time is up. Like no one, I remember even the night I left San Jose, there was a party going on, a rager. And I was at this house that I lived at with like 12 dudes and the whole house was bare except for one dude. And he was like the last one. And he's like, hey man, you're leaving tonight, aren't you? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, wow, LA, you know? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, all right, man. Well, you know, good luck. I was like, all right, bro. And then he goes, hey man, since you're going, you know, since you're leaving, can you drop me off at the party? And I'm like, all right. So now he's in my car. I got my car packed up at that time with all my belongings, which were a skateboard, a leather jacket, a boom box, and like, you know, a handful of clothes. I had my Ford Escort, broken window, you know, I'm driving. And I remember I pull up in front of the house and he's like, all right, dude, good luck. And as I pull away, it was just this house in San Jose. And it felt like everyone in Northern California was at this party. And I felt like, dude, they're having a party because I'm bailing. Like they're not doing the, like, this isn't the party. Like I know, and this is so messed up in my head. I visualized they're celebrating that I'm fucking bailing, not like, hey dude, good luck. Like, yeah, good riddance. Wow. And I remember I was driving and like, dude, I was emotional and I was bummed. And that record Goo Goo Dolls, I just put it on. And I remember I was already into it, but like you said, Brad, I just listened to it nonstop. So like, I was so into them. And then, you know, obviously all my punk rock stuff, The Clash and, you know, that was super, you know, Ramones, all that stuff. But that was one of the leading bands on that little note I put. And they had just come through LA and played the Lingerie. And I saw them and I didn't know it, but the other guys in Wax were there as well. So when I put the Goo Goo Dolls on there, they were like, that's our dude. Like, right. We got to meet this guy. So when I went up there, you know, we hit it off right away. And then I always say the best thing about, like, I loved playing in those guys with Wax because they were from Chicago. So it was like they had a different vibe. They weren't sketchy, you know, like I'd already kind of jammed with some people from LA that just, you're like, dude, this isn't my vibe. Like, you know, like I needed to jam with people that like called their parents on Sundays, you know, like that was just kind of who I was, you know? Sure. And, they were like that, you know? So it was like, it was cool. And then I remember, I always say like the common ground was like, we all love The Clash. We all love the Ramones. But like at that point in my life, I was not into the Replacements and they like totally were like Replacements, Soul Asylum, you know, like they're really turning me on to that. And then big time, like, Pixies. Like I'd never, I knew about the Pixies. I'd seen the Pixies play. It was not my thing, but like, I would say the two bands that they just turned me on to and like, and if you listen to Wax, it's definitely influenced. I was about to say the Pixie.
The Wax guitar sound just made a lot more sense now that you mentioned that. Yeah.
Soda was so into the Pixies, so into the Replacements. But the thing I'd learned from them, because so I was coming with, you know, I remember I played them my band Frontline, like, and I thought like, man, they're gonna think this is cool. And they were like, yeah, you know, they weren't impressed. And I was like, wow. Okay. Like I thought we were kind of rad, but then when I started playing with them, I realized, oh my God, like these guys, you know, like Soda used to always say to me, like we would write a song or whatever. And like his whole thing was, is like, it, you know, if it feels like it's going to be predictable, if it feels like it's going to go here, that means we can't go there. We have to go the other way.
Love that. Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay. And then the thing that was great with being in a band with those guys was they on their own, they could have fronted the band on their own. They could write their own songs on their own. They could write their own lyrics. I remember a big thing was, is they were like, you know, we write, you know, each one of us kind of writes a lot. And like, you know, do you mind singing other people's lyrics? And I was like, dude, if it's good, I have no problem. And then, you know, as long as I can, you know, if I can also, you know, be like writing my own songs. And on that first record, man, it's like, you know, throughout the whole, both records, we really wrote a lot together, but like, I loved collaborating like that. And the thing I loved about being in the band with those three dudes was the first time we ever played. It was like, it was so great to be in a band where like the pressure of like being the front man, like even though I was the front man, but like I didn't have to like carry the whole fucking thing. Mm-hmm. Like I was able to, like I knew Dave, he could talk in the mic and just, you know, everyone was into it. And then Loomis, he could say something, you know, like Soda, like it was so cool being in a band with four performers instead of just like, okay, you're the singer, you're the guy that goes for it. And the other guys are kind of quiet. Like, you know, it was like all four of us were into it. And then the best thing was that all four wanted it so fucking bad. Like when we did a show, you know, it would be at the end of the night, like, yo, dude, fucking, you know what it reminds me of, Brad? It's like Johnny T and Dino, like just always working it. Like, dude, I got this phone number from this producer. Great. Hey, dude, I found out we can get studio time over here. Okay. What's that guy's number? Oh, hey, dude, I spoke to the booker. She said we could do this. Did you get her number? Yes. You know how those guys used to just, you know, it was like they were scientists, and that's what being in Wax was like.
That's so cool, man. I just recently watched the rewatch, you know, the Wax California video, which is obviously like so iconic. You know, at that time, who actually conceived that idea about a man on fire, and how did you guys wind up connecting with Spike Jonze to do that?
Spike came up with the whole idea.
Oh, cool.
It was one of those. Yeah, it was all him. At that point, Spike and Wax's relationships is super, it goes back to skateboarding, you know, once again. Okay. Spike took photos. He was into BMX. He skated. And at that point he was taking photos. He had directed a few videos by the time he, you know, did the Guy on Fire video, he was happening. But
yeah,
but the way we met him was the first video that Spike ever did was for Wax. You can see it. It's this video called Wax, and it's our video for Caroline Records, and it's this song called Hush. And Spike was our friend. And we basically, we needed someone to direct a video when we were on Caroline. And we had this friend of ours, Dan Fields, who was kind of our like go-to guy. He wasn't managing our band, but he ran a skate shop out of Chicago. He later on went on to manage Weezer. He worked with Chris Cornell. Like he was just, but at this point he was just a friend of ours. And he was the one that introduced me to Matt Hensley. So like when I'd go to Chicago, I would stay at Dan's house, and living at Dan's house at that time was Matt Hensley. And like, you know, when I was singing in Wax, we just became friends, you know, like this is, and it's so weird because, you know, there was no idea that, you know, he would go on to, you know, be in Flogging Molly you know, I'd sign him and that would be one of the biggest bands we worked with.
Of course,
but at that point, him and I would just bond over like, we both love like reggae, you know, like old, you know, reggae, Sharp Skin, just all that stuff. So I would go up there, he'd make me cassettes and we would just talk music. And Dan, when it came down to doing our first video, we were like, yeah, we got to shoot a video for this song Hush on our first record. And it just, Dan was one of those kind of guys. He's like, yeah, you should have Spike do the video. And we're like, yeah, that'd be cool. And I remember like Dan just had this persona and just this vibe that you trusted him. And he said, yeah, Spike will do a good job. And none of us said, hey, has Spike ever done a video? It was just, yeah, Spike's doing the video.
Right.
So then I remember he comes out to Chicago and we shoot that first video. And, you know, that's a story in itself, but we ended up doing that first video. But then what had happened by the time we did the California video, you know, there was a moment where, you know, we were on Caroline Records. We made our first record for Caroline, and then Virgin Records owned Caroline. And there was this moment where they went to our management and they said, hey, check it out. We're doing this thing where bands that are on Caroline, Smashing Pumpkins, Drop 19s, And Wax, what we'd like to do is we'd like their next record, you know, to come out on Virgin. Mm. And at that time on Virgin, it was like Janet Jackson and, you know, that like music, you know, first of all, we were nothing like the Smashing Pumpkins. And in my mind, I'm like, you know, I don't know. How's that going to work, us being on like now the full major?
Was this kind of coinciding time-wise with like the sort of Offspring, Green Day, major
no,
label
that's
thing?
The
this-
problem. No, okay. That's that. That's where the whole problem lied. Gotcha. Basically what ended up happening is we make our record for Virgin. We go to Boston and we record with Paul Coldry and Sean Slade. They had just done Radiohead, Pablo Honey.
Okay.
And the whole reason we wanted to work with them was because of that chunk chunk on the song,
on Creep. Yeah. On Creep.
On Creep.
Yeah.
Like we literally, that single was out, that record came out. And I remember Soda was like, we just kept playing that, and we didn't even play the whole song. We just kept playing that chunk chunk, which is so funny because
I did the same thing. I don't know what it is, but I did the same exact thing.
Yeah. And you know what's so funny, Benny? On 59 Sound, I always, whenever I hear Alex do the, he does a chunk chunk before it goes in the chorus. Sure. And I always used to say to myself, and it's funny, I never brought that up to you guys. I was always like, oh my God, that's kind of like that chunk chunk in you know, I'm a Creep, you know, and I love that. Huh. So anyway, we end up making our record with those guys. And I was so psyched to work with them because I was more excited because they had worked with the Lemonheads. They had done all the Boston records. And like at this point, I didn't know the Boston's. I was just a fan. So like going to Boston and recording in their studio and working with the guys that worked with these artists, I was so psyched on.
Yeah.
And we turned in our record. And we turned it into, I remember we turned it in probably around like August to Virgin. And I remember it's like September rolls around, October rolls around. We were having a kind of couple meetings and I'll never forget it. Like we got called in November and they said, yeah, we're going to have a meeting. Okay, cool. And we walked in and I knew we were in trouble when they're like Virgin's attorney was there and like no one from the label. And like, it was like a scene out of Goodfellas.
So not a meeting, an ambush.
Yeah.
It's
and
like
basically,
in Goodfellas when like,
oh, dude,
you know, Pesci
so
thought
much.
He was going to get brought up and he just got taken out in the garage, you know?
Yeah. I thought we were going to talk about 120 minutes. They're talking about dropping us.
Right,
and we walked in and I remember the president came in, this guy named Phil Cordero, and he was this Italian dude and he was super cool and he'd always been great to me. And he just, you know, he said to me, Joe, you know, it's, you know, guys, I'm sorry. It's just, we're feeling what you got. And cause at that point there is no Offspring. There is no Green Day. There is no, like what we're doing is not like Pearl Jam. It's nothing like what's happening. And we didn't even look like those bands. I mean, we had, you know, slick back hair and collared shirts and peg pants with creepers. Like that was our vibe. And, when we turned, you know, so they finally just were like, it's not happening. So we were dropped. And then at that moment, like we went into this weird, like this weird time where we weren't on a label. And then I was kind of like, I slipped back into my DIY San Jose, just background. And I was like, well, fuck, you know, we got to put the record out ourselves, you know? Okay. And of course the guys in Wax were like, what are you talking about? Because they weren't from that background.
Yeah,
they were like,
sure.
Yeah, I don't know. And then, it was about a year and a half of just back and forth. And I finally got the record from Virgin. You know, I went and had a meeting with Phil Cordero and he was, I just said, you got to give me the record. And he was like, you're crazy. You know, and at that time they were like, we spent $50,000 on the record, which was a lot, you know?
Yeah,
and I was
sure.
Like, I know, but you got to give me the record. And he's like, why? And I'm like, because, you know, you promised me that you were going to take care of me and you're not. And this isn't fair. And I'm 24 years old and my life's on halt until you give me this record. Like, just give it to me. You guys aren't going to do anything with it. I remember he signed over the paperwork and I went to go get the masters.
He actually gave it to you.
He gave me the record.
Oh my God.
Virgin. Dude, it's crazy because
an appeal to humanity and consciousness actually got you the record back. That's like,
not only did he give me the record and total do a solid job. I went down. I remember I got the record. And at that point, you know, Spike had, at this point now he's gone from like, you know, this guy that's doing videos to like Beastie Boys, you know, Weezer. I mean, he's massive. He's like, he's on the spaceship. And he told me, when this had happened to us, he said, hey man, I'm going to, you know, he said, Joe, you know, it's so a shame what's happened. You know, we ran into each other somewhere and he goes, look, you know, if you guys get re-signed or any way I can help you, I will do a video. Like, I'll do it. And I go, really? And I go, cause I'm trying to get the record back. He's like, dude, I'll do the video. Like, count me in, like, whatever it takes. I'm going to be there for you guys. So now fast forward, you know, we're out on tour with Wax and I'm like, we're going to go and support the record. And I think this is right around the time, Brad, that I meet you and the Goops. Cause we came out to New York and like D-Generation put us on a show. And then like we did, I think that's like when I met you all and like we started, you know, doing shows out on New York. We'd been out there obviously because, you know, we'd started going there early, but now like we were out there, we were doing some shows and I remember touring on our own and like the record was out and, before I left to go on the road on this particular tour and support this new thing that we were going to do on our own, I remember we were practicing at this studio and Scott Whelan was there. And I'd known Scott from when we both got signed, you know, and Stone Temple Pilots. And, you know, like he was a good friend. Okay. And before I left on this tour, I ended up giving him a copy of our record. And he was like, I love, you're doing your own label. Like, I just remember at this point, Stone Temple Pilots was just massive.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, so cool and just always super supportive of Wax. But he was basically like, you know, they were getting in their bus and we were getting in this van and he's like, hey, I heard you put out your own record. And I was like, yeah. So I give him the record and he's like, can I have a couple of them? I'm like, sure. You know, all right. He's like, this is so great. Like, this is your own label. And I'm like, yeah, but like, I'm not stoked on it. Like, he's way more stoked on it than I am. Yeah. And I end up giving him the record and I go on this tour. And while we're out on the road, I remember it was pre-cell phones. We get all these, you know, we go to, you know, you couldn't talk to anyone unless you went to the club.
Right.
And I remember I called Karen, my girlfriend at that time. And I said, hey, you know, what's up? She's like, oh my God, we've been trying to get a hold of you. And I go, what's up? And she's like, you'll never believe what happened last night and on K-Rock. And that was like the biggest station. I go, what happened? Scott Whelan took over the K-Rock airwaves all night. And in my head, I'm like, fuck, good for him. That must be rad. Yeah. You know, like you know what I did last night? I slept on a couch that was on fire to stay warm. That's what I did last night. You know, I'm looking at the band and at this point, you guys too, and you guys know this from being in a band, we're out in the middle of nowhere. We're playing squats. You know, and the three guys in Wax, I remember, I can see it right now. They're smoking cigarettes. They're waiting to get on the phone themselves and they're ready to quit. Like they were, you know, David told me like, dude, this isn't why I moved to LA to drive. You know, this sucks. Last year we're on 120 minutes. Now we're dropped. I'm not into it. And as she's telling me, Scott Whelan took over, you know, K-Rock. She goes, no, Joe, you're never going to believe it. All he did last night was play Wax. And I go, what? She goes, whoa. He just kept playing that song, California. He would play Stone Temple Pilots and then he'd play California. He must have played. And I go, what? And she goes, and this morning we woke up and they're playing it. And I go, what the fuck are you talking about?
Crazy.
And then I'm looking there and I'm, you know, at that moment and for every, like for the people who are listening, like what I'm trying to say is this, like whatever the Spotify playlist that you follow that has, you know, 6 million followers or 100, you know, 1 million followers, imagine your band is the first song on that playlist. Yeah, like, you know how they make those playlists like punk rock for the summer. And it's always like, boom, you know, some massive band or like, hey, get your barbecue grill on right now. And it's like, you know, Creedence Clearwater right there at number one. Dude, imagine your band. It's like, hey, you know, summer jams at 220. Everything sucks except this music. And then it's like, boom, your band's the first thing. And overnight you go from like zero followers to all of a sudden you're like, Jesus Christ. And that was the equivalent of what happened on being on K-Rock because all of the other stations that programmed off K-Rock started playing this band, Wax.
Yeah, I think so. People don't realize this, but like in the 90s, especially K-Rock dictated
everything.
Anything that K-Rock played not only got picked up by all these other stations across the country, but that's where MTV got their fucking what videos they were going to put into rotation came directly from K-Rock.
This was still the narrative even for me. You know, many years later, this was still that important of a
getting
station.
Played on K-Rock. Yeah. Is like,
oh yeah,
it's literally the top of the pile.
Benny, I mean, when we did the 59 Sound,
you really trying to trying to get it on there pretty hard.
Oh yeah. K-Rock was the only station that wouldn't. Right. I remember when 59 Sound came out, I got into a huge argument because they wouldn't add it, and everyone else was adding it. And then when we came, and then when you guys came, it was like, I remember you guys come through opening a first of three, and it was like you guys, Alkaline Trio, and then Against Me. Yeah, who's headlining at that point?
That one was Rise Against.
There you go.
Alkaline Trio on Thrice. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're the first of three. And then I remember we came back and we headlined our own show, you know, sold out, and it was just fucking insane. And I remember, at that point, it was like we had everyone on that single, and it was almost like they were too late on it. And it was just like, all right, it's already gone. It's already, we did it. We don't, you know, we don't need it now. Like, no, it's okay. We don't need your van parked out front. Yeah. Goodbye. Right, you know, right. I remember they wanted to have the presents or something, and it was like, no way. Like, dude, like, of course, you know, it's like, you don't get to tell everyone it's your party when you didn't want us to be at it. You know, it's like, you know, and that was so, that. But the thing I will say about K-Rock was when they did get behind, cause there were records that, K-Rock would get behind, you know, and they would add Flogging Molly, MXPX, and it was a game changer. Right. But at this particular time, it was like such a game changer, because when we got back to Los Angeles, we not only were we dropped and when we left, but I'll never forget it. There used to be this saying, and this will totally date me, was there was a saying when you were talking to people, they said, yeah, I'll believe it when I see the deal. And then the next thing was, I'll believe it when you fax me the deal. Like, that's how you got a deal. It wasn't an email. They would fax it. So you would sit there and they would fax a deal through. Now, a record contract, you guys got to remember, a record contract is like, it can be up to like 27, 30 pages, something like that, right? So then I remember I come home and, you know, we first of all, we're driving across the United States and we start hearing our song on the radio, which was fucking surreal, because we're like, how the fuck did they even get it? So by the time we get to LA, our attorney goes, you know, his name was Jeffrey Light, and he used to like talk like, all right, boys, things have changed. And I'm like, yeah, dude, one thing that's changed is you're calling me back. I've been trying to call you. Like, oh yeah. You know, like, he was just so like, his letters embroidered on his shirt, you know. He's like, all right, guys, here's the deal. And he's like, all right, so far we've got an offer from Lava Records. Jason Flom has a brand new label. We got a deal from Atlantic on the table. I got a call from Interscope. They want to meet with you guys. And you know who else called? Phil Cordero from Virgin. Thought, you ready for this? The people at Virgin, they thought they still owned the record. Phil had to tell them, no, I gave it back. So they tried to re-sign us. It was one of the best moments in my life, when Phil's like, we sat down and he's like, hey, and I just said, you know, he's like, God, it's crazy how, you know, the things happen. And, you know, and I just said, Phil, there's, you know, come on, there's just no way we can sign back to Virgin. You dropped us, be so crazy. And then I remember all that we talked about was we wanted to be on Interscope, because at that point it was like Jimmy Iving, Tom Wally, they were the guys running the company. And the bands that were breaking on there were like, it was Hole, it was, who else? Bush, what else? A Tragic Kingdom with No Doubt. Yeah. It was just, you know, Wallflowers were on there. Yeah. It was just like happening. And I remember it was so surreal. We go over there. And they go, okay, they want to have I'll never forget, our lawyer goes, all right, so here's the deal. We're gonna sign the deal from Atlantic. And I go, really? And he goes, yeah. He goes, I want to have this one done. And I remember my girlfriend and I, Karen at that point, I lived in Venice. And I do remember one night, like, I come home and, you know, it was so surreal. We open up our front door, and what had happened was all of those labels faxed the record deal to my fax number, because that was the side one fax thing. And they were like, here's the deal. And we walked in and there was paper all over our apartment. And it was literally all these record deals. I'm sitting there and I'm like, holy shit. This is nuts. So we go to Interscope, and I remember it was so anticlimactic, you know, from the first time, you know, when we got signed to Caroline, it's like champagne and everyone's high-fiving and all these dreams and oh my God, you know, everyone's just patting us on the back. This deal at Interscope, dude, we show up there probably 9 o'clock at night, place is closed. We go upstairs, we walk into a room. It's Jimmy Iving. It's the head of finance. It's their attorney. It's their radio promo guy. And then this other guy, the guy that, Nigel Harrison, who's the bass player in Blondie, oddly enough, he was our A&R guy. And he was super cool. He was the one that pulled it all together. He was like a fan of Wax from the beginning. And so we go in there, and I remember we sit down, and Jimmy walks in, and the band's there, and we're all just, you know, thank you for taking the meeting. He's like, all right, so here's the deal. You know, what are you guys looking for? And I remember, it sounds crazy to say, but you know, we wanted $400,000. Each guy wanted $100,000 because we heard the Chili Peppers got that. They're like, yeah, that's what we want. And then he's like, all right. And then he goes, okay, what else? And then our bass player goes, cause he was, you know, super like into like who was happening. He goes, Bush is on tour right now. And we want to go. And at some point we'd love to be on tour with Bush. And he goes, okay, he writes that down. And then he goes, all right. The radio guy comes in, he goes, okay, so the single's on this many stations. If you guys sign here, this is what we're thinking we can do. And then at that moment I go, hey, you know, we got to do a video for the song, and Spike Jonze says he'll do it. And I remember Jimmy's like, really? And I'm all, yeah. He's like, how's that going to happen? And we go, he's our friend. He's like, all right, writes it down. Okay. So Spike's going to do your video. You guys want to be on tour with Bush, and you guys are looking for $400,000. He goes, okay, give me a second. And then he goes into another room where the finance guys was, and we're kind of just sitting there. And you got to remember, dude, no one's talking. It's totally quiet. I don't even think they offered us a drink. Like, everyone's just sitting there. Yeah. You know, we're just kind of like, all right, whatever. And then all of a sudden Jimmy comes back and he goes, all right, so the finance on it. Yeah. $400,000, not a problem. Okay. Spike Jonze going to do the video. Okay. We'll put together a separate budget for that. And you guys need to be in Buffalo at the end of next week to start with Bush.
Wow.
And we just look at each other, and he goes, anything else you guys need? And I remember we're like, no.
Yeah.
And then they go, okay, you're going to go in this other room. So then we go in the other room with our attorney. Once again, totally silent. It's dark outside. You know, you got to remember, up until this moment, you guys, I am fucking broke. I have used every credit card to finance renting vans for, you know, the tour where we lit the couch on fire to, you know, to making CDs. And in my world, I have maxed my credit. Like I'm like, oh my, I owe my dad. The other thing was I borrowed $5,000 from my dad, and I go, okay, I got to owe my dad $5,000. And then I have this credit card with about, oh my God, like $10,000 in credit. So all that's going through my head is I got to pay that off. And I remember signing everything. We get it all done. And then they're like, all right, welcome to Interscope. No champagne, nothing. Just everyone shook hands. You know, we thank Jimmy. Jimmy's like, all right, you know, good luck, you guys. You know, I'll talk to you guys when you get out on the Bush tour. And we're like, all right. And then, you know, they tell us, all right, this is how we're going to have another meeting to set up the release of the record, you know, boom, boom, boom. Okay, cool. And then I'll never forget this. So now we're signed to Interscope, and it was so weird. We go downstairs, and the band, we were so at that point, like just kind of over it, but like realizing, well, you know what, we're back in, but right. Like there was no celebrating. Like, I don't, you know, it wasn't like we all ran and go, oh my God, that's, we were, you know, we just, everyone had been through it once already. And I remember everyone just went downstairs and they went their separate ways. Huh. And I remember I was sitting there and I was by myself on Wilshire, and I'm like, fuck, I don't have any money to get home. Like, I have no money. And I don't have a ride. I don't have anything. And then I remember the Nigel Harrison came down about a half hour later, and I was still standing there, and he goes, what's up, man? And I go, Nigel, this is so lame. I don't have any, like, you know, there's no Uber then. I'm like, I don't even know how to get back to Venice right now. You know? And he's like, oh God. And he looks at me, he goes, man, you got $100,000, but you don't have any money. I go, no. And he goes, I remember he goes over to his ATM and took out the max amount, which, you know, was probably $200, which in my mind was like, holy shit. And he goes, here you go, man. Just get it back to me when you can. And I remember I got in a cab and I get back to Venice. And I remember I walk into my apartment, you know, and Karen's sitting on the couch and she's just looking at me. And she's like, you know, at this point it's like, you know, 11:30 at night. And I sit down on the couch and she's just looking at me, and she's been with me on this whole entire ride from when oh my God, dude, she just, you know, we got dropped. We had a, you know, I remember, you know, it was like we couldn't make rent. You know, I was still, you know, she was so supportive and just like, all right, you know, like this is it, you know, married to a singer in a band. And I remember I sat on the couch and she's just looking at me, and then she goes, so what happened? And I just remember I looked at her and I go, we signed Interscope and we're back in. Like, it's fucking on. And she's like, are you serious? And I'm like, yeah, we leave for tour next week to meet up with Bush. And she's like, what? You know, cause at that point that's like, you know, telling someone you're going, you know, I know some people might be listening like Bush, like I know it, you know, whatever band is happening at this moment, it's like, what, you know, you're going to go on tour with them. And it was just like, I was like, yeah, we're back in. And it was just like, it was like a rocket ship, man. And then about a week later, before we left, that's what was crazy. Before we left on the Bush tour, we did the Spike video. I called him and he's like, I totally want to do it. But the thing that was so funny about the video for with Spike was Spike didn't know what he wanted to do for that video. We shot it on a Saturday and it was like Monday. He didn't know. Tuesday. He didn't know. I didn't even get on the phone with him until like Wednesday. And then Interscope called me and they're like, this guy, Spike, he won't tell us what he's filming. I mean, he's asking for, I think he got like 400 grand or something. Oh, he's like, he is not telling us what he's going to do. And I'm like, yeah, I know. That's how he works. We're not used to working that way. And then they were like, well, and I go, look, man, he's doing it. But he was so on, no pun intended. He was so on fire. They were just like, okay.
Yeah.
And I remember he calls me on a Thursday night and he goes, hey, he's like, what's up, Joe? I go, hey, dude, I'm psyched for Saturday. And I'm trying to be cool. I'm like, hey, so like, do you kind of know what like we might do? And I'll never forget. He goes, I just did a fire hose video. And I go, really? He goes, yeah. And he goes, I loved filming. We did some stuff with fire and we did it in slow motion. Have you ever seen fire in slow motion? And in my head, I'm like, no, you know, like, no, I haven't. He's like, yeah, it looks so cool. Yeah, man, I think I want to do something with that. And I go, really? He goes, okay, see you Saturday. And I'm like, all right. So we literally showed up to the video shoot and that's when he goes, all right, so here's the deal. You know, Stuntman Dan is going to fucking run by you guys on fire. Joe, you're standing here. Soda, you're here. Da, 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 da. Okay, cool. And literally the, you know, guy, you know, he filmed it in real time, obviously. So they'd light a guy on fire. The guy would run down Gardner Street.
Do you remember who the guy was?
Yeah. I want to say his name was Dan. And we partied with that guy because across
yeah, what was his vibe. Yeah.
What was Fireman's vibe? Dude, he was so rad. Dude, you ready for this? This is where it gets crazy because of that guy. And I want to say his name was Dan because of Stuntman Dan, that's like Loomis, Johnny Knoxville, all of those guys were really in, like, they were like, dude, stunts are rad. And that's where, like, that whole germ for, like, we're going to do our own stunts. That's where all the, that's kind of like where the germ for Jackass kind of started because even in our first video, Hush, if you watch it, Loomis rides his bike into the front of a car and he was really into stunts. And one of the guys at that point that was like one of our friends and he was just a dude that hung out. He was auditioning for parts. He always had a book in his back pocket. He was pretty quiet. He was super subdued. Like, and that was Johnny Knoxville.
Huh.
And we just called him Knoxville and he always hung out and he was always super cool, but he was not the guy that, you know, we know now. He was just another dude that hung out and drank beers with us, you know? And then Loomis and him were super tight. His name was, you know, we used to call him PJ. And that, you know, we're like, hey, and then, you know, he was from Knoxville. So then, you know, hey, Knoxville. So then him and Loomis, you know, they were always super tight. And then that's kind of like where I feel like that germ for Jackass and all that shit started from, because, you know, obviously it was Spike and it was Johnny and Loomis was one of those guys, but they were really into stunts. And that guy Dan was fucking cool that I remember after we shot the video, because they closed down Sunset Boulevard, which was insane. They closed down Gardner and like across the street there was this restaurant called El Compadre. And we, after the video shoot, went in there and shut that place down. And one of the things that we were doing was like lighting the bar on fire, lighting Dan on fire. Like, we were lighting everything on fire at that point. And then
quickly, what's the process of lighting a human in a controlled fire inside of a bar? Like what? Like,
oh no, no, he would just do it on his hand. Basically what was going on was for the video, you know, he would be in this weird retardant thing and like he, you know, fire retardant thing. And like he had all this gear on and they'd lather him down and all this stuff. And then, you know, they light him on fire and he runs down the street. But in the bar, he was showing us like just, you know, he was just doing like bar tricks and those guys were stoked. And, the way I always say it is like, it's the way it went down and the way it all happened is almost like a movie. And that sometimes when I tell the story, I'm like, wow, did we really do that? And I look back on it and go, yeah, we did. Yeah, totally. And it just blows my mind. It just seriously blows my mind. And
I feel like Stuntman Dan deserves some mechanicals off of Jackass, you know?
Yeah, probably. I think they used him.
Oh, they did. Okay, good. So he got to make it in.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, he was just, yeah, he was, that was, yeah, that was, that whole thing was insane. And then, you know, the thing that made it even crazier was like, you know, 6 months earlier, we couldn't get arrested. Now we had like the number one song on K-Rock, and then we had the number one video. And then, you know, like they had to do this thing every time they played it, they had to play an announcement that said, do not try this at home. These are trained. And it was the first time ever in the history of MTV that they had to play, like this video announcement before our video. So that just made the attention on the video so much more. Right. And, you know, that, so that was insane. But the one thing I always remember was when Spike brought the video in to show us and the people at Interscope, the video, right?
Yeah.
So they've just paid for this video. They haven't seen anything. They don't know what is going on. You know, they go, okay, cool. I'll never forget. They show the video And I want to say Tom Wally, who was like, you know, either the vice president or, you know, major head at Interscope, sure. Super cool guy.
Big dog. Always he's cool. A big dog.
Yeah. Big dog. Yeah. He's a big guy and super cool to us. And I remember Spike shows the video and I remember the video ends. Now, if you've seen the video, you know what the video is. For people that haven't seen the video, the band isn't in it. There's a guy on fire that runs by four dudes. Yeah. So if you don't know who Wax is, you're like, wow, that's a cool video of a dude on fire. Totally. You don't see what the guys in the band look like. I mean, if you knew the band, you're like, oh, there's Joe, there's Loomis, there's Soda, there's Dave. But like, if you don't, the band is not in it. And the first thing, I'll never forget, the video ends and everyone's quiet. Like no one says, fuck yeah. Like we're all just sitting there. And then Tom goes, can we see that again? So he plays it again and then it ends. And I remember he just looks over and he goes, why isn't the band in the video? And then we go, we are in it. We are in it. Man. We're in it. Yeah. And he looks, he goes, I'm talking about the band in the video. And I remember we're like, so at this point, now this is just, so here's the thing you got to look at. So as a record company owner that I am, I totally get where he's coming from.
Sure.
Like I can get where he's like, I just fucking threw down a ton of cash and you're telling me the four dudes that wrote this song and that are in it are not in it. And the thing is, he even said the guys in Wax, they look cool. They like, we need people to see what they look like. Like that's how you make a band popular. So that people start, you know, wearing the little beard that Loomis has or the little pants Soda has, or all of a sudden you see 6 years old with their hair slicked back like Joe, like that's what we want. And I remember,
and for reference too, this is like way before the Artie video thing.
Oh, totally. Like thing. And dude, Benny, you ready for this? This was the best part. I don't know who said it, but one of the people at Interscope said, I'm not paying for Spike Jonze art project. Nah. That was their exact quote. And you ready for this? Now this is the band, and Benny, you know this, Brad, you know this, you know, when you're a band and when you're young and you're full of fucking, you know, just fucking clove cigarettes and cheap beer. We were like, fuck that, dude. This video is rad. And like Spike doesn't want us in it. So we're not in it. Yeah. Like we stuck together. Awesome. And we were like, nah, man, that's our video. And looking back on it, what ended up happening was okay, first of all, is the video iconic? Fuck yeah. But I'll tell you right now, the video became way bigger than the band did. It's like that video did become iconic for Spike, and I'm stoked that we're a part of it. But I will say this, us not being in it, was what made it fucking cool. If we would have been like, if it would have been cutaways to us in some little fucking place playing, it would have ruined it.
Right.
So I'm stoked that we stuck true with, you know, and trusted Spike because the video became iconic and I'm super proud to be a part of it. But I just remember the look on their faces. They were just so bummed.
Yeah.
They were just like, what the hell did you guys just turn in? And I was, you know, we were like, fuck it. Like, I remember they were like, well, we need to re-edit it. And of course, you know, we went for like, you know, new artist on the label, you know, well, if you do that, then we don't want anything to do with it. All right. Wow. And then they put it out and then it fucking, you know, obviously it took off, but, that was how that whole thing came about.
Too fucking funny. I love it, man. Well, I want to get into some comedy a little, 'cause I know this is your passion now. You have You're a good 6-7 years into being a comic at this point, no?
11, bro.
11 full on?
Wow. 11 full on years. I mean, it's of getting up.
It's so cool. Yeah. And such a cool shift in what you've been doing. So, you know, just for people who don't know, what was like the impetus for getting into it, and how did you create your character and your act like going into this? Was it all just an extension of those spoken words, or was there a different intention in mind going into it?
I mean, what happened was all my peers, you know, that were singers in bands or in bands, they all started picking up acoustic guitars. And right. I was like, you know what? That's not my vibe. And not that I don't like that vibe, but like, I can't do what Chuck Reagan does. I can't do it.
Joe, from my end, thank God. Okay. We don't need another, one, you know?
No, you know, it's like Chuck does it so
amazing. Another one of these drummerless fucking bands, you know? Come on. I know you don't have to pay anyone on tour. I get it.
Jeez. You know, the other thing is though, and you know this, Benny, from being in a band, it's like, you know, it's like the drummer's going to get way more of a phone call than a singer. Brad, you know that. It's like, you know, if someone calls and goes, hey man, we're starting a band and we want Joe Sib to sing, you know, like, all right, we're bringing a vibe to the table. Like we're bringing combs. We're bringing a lot of hair product, a lot of coffee. Sure. We're bringing a lot of dudes and bros. Like there's going to be a lot of, no way, dude, I'm so stoked that we're writing this rad song. It's fucking rad. Like, I don't know. Do we want that?
Vernacular. Yeah.
Yeah. Like he's going to be talking in a language we might not understand. Right. We don't know. Yes. We don't, you know, like he's going to wear shorts in winter. Like what is going to, you know, like will he be able to survive? And I think that I just, you know, I remember the, you know, no one was calling me to join a band. Right. And after 22 Jacks, I was just like, I had worked so hard with 22 Jacks and not that it didn't go where I wanted it to, but I was like, you know what? And I remember this, you know, and I don't know if it's cool to quote him or not. I love him, but you know, Henry Rollins said something once when he stopped playing music. He said, you know what? That I had learned everything I could learn from that, you know, platform of entertainment. Totally. And I not, you know, like obviously I'm not using words like him, but I remember I just was like, I think I've done that. Like that I don't want to be in a band, but like, I think I've done it. Yeah. So I just stopped, but I took 10 years off. You know, I was like, you know, I didn't start comedy until I was in my 40s.
Right.
And, you know, I stopped and I just focused on side one 100%. You know, that was what I did.
Sure.
And then I remember I wanted to get back on stage and I came up with this idea for some spoken word story that I wrote called California Calling. Right. I did that. Right. I worked hard on it. People were really into it. And then that led to me one night doing it at the Improv in Hollywood at the Comedy Club. And I'd never been in there. I'd never even been in that place, driven by it a million times. Sure, but I was like, yeah. And then the woman that ran it, this woman named Emily, who went on to be one of the main bookers at the Comedy Store right now.
Oh, okay.
She was like punk rock fan into the bands. And she was like, oh my God, I love your spoken word show. You know, will you do it at the Improv? And I did it and it was great. And then that next night next day or something, we were talking and she's like, I was like, I want to do stand up, you know? And she's like, well, you know, if you want to, you know, try to do 7 minutes or 6 minutes here. And I was like, whoa, 6 minutes. Like how do you even get the mic out of the stand in 6 minutes? You know, like, I don't know. So then, at that time I did the show also at the Comedy Store and, Pauly Shore at that point, you know, I've known him forever. You know, he was always super friendly to me. When I was in Wax, we were in Biodome together.
Biodome.
We were in Biodome and, I was in the dome, bro. and he was just, you know, he found out I was doing the show and he's like, buddy, you know, my mom built the main room for what you're doing. You should try it. And I did it there and it did really well. And then I remember I asked him, I said, you know, I want to try to start doing stand-up. And he put me in touch with the booker. And I went up there and I remember it was January 7th, like I want to say it. So 11 years ago. And, I went up there and, I did a 6 minutes or 7 minutes in the belly room there. Okay. And, you know, at that point, you know, I was still kind of like figuring out, am I going to tell stories? Am I going to, you know, whatever. And, you know, it wasn't good, but it wasn't bad. Like I've always been able to get laughs. Like even when I bomb, I can still get laughs. Like I've never been one of those guys that like get up there and just don't get any laughs. But the thing I will say is that I've gotten laughs, but like, you know, once you start doing it, you know, you start asking yourself like, what kind of laugh do I want to get? Which, you know, that took me about, you know, 8 years to figure out, like, do you want to get a laugh that like, oh, cool, that guy was super funny and he's totally you know, I won't ever remember any, you know, think how many times you've gone to a comic club and you don't remember any of the comics you've seen, but you remember laughing.
Sure.
And then,
sure.
you know, it's like, you start really thinking about like, what kind of laugh do you want to get? Do you want to get a laugh that's like, oh, that was funny. That was a dick joke. That was a joke, you know, that got the room to laugh. It was hacky, but it made everyone laugh. Okay. Or do you want to do a joke that the next day someone is taking your words and they're able to say them to a friend at work, the bit you did. Mm. And the joke is so good that that person has no comedy experience gets the laugh. Like, you know, like that's how great like Bill Burr is, or like, right, you know, like a guy like Chappelle. Like, you can tell someone a bit that Chappelle is doing and the other person will laugh even though you're not Chappelle. That's the test of like how great the dude's material is.
Because they're making some point that really like, that really rings with you instead of just giving you a chuckle or something.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And it's like, if I could tell you, like, you know, if you and I are sitting there and we're just two guys and I go, oh man, I saw Bill Burr the other night and he did this whole bit about, you know, when the military gets to get on the plane first before anyone else. Is that really cool? Does that really make sense for the guy that just waves the flag for the person to land on the air? Like, does that guy get to get on before me? Right. And then, you know, like you laugh, you're like, dude, that is funny. I've never thought of that. You know?
Yeah.
You know, that shows that that's a great bit. And then what ended up happening for me was, you know, I had the confidence from being on stage for singing in bands. So like, that wasn't something I had to learn. Sure. But what I had to start doing is like, I was like, all right, what's going to be my, you know, what's going to be my vibe and my energy that people are going to relate to? And, you know, how are you going to find what they call your voice? And, you know, I remember people talking about it takes 10 years to find your voice. And I, in my head, I was like, nah, that won't be the case. And it really was like, I don't feel like
10 years, dog. No.
Exactly. And I worked, you know, the thing I would say though, is that when I say like finding your voice, it's really finding out like what's your perspective on things, what's going to be that thing that the audience relates to you, you know, cause the thing is when you go on stage, it's like everyone in the room, you know, I always say with stand-up comedy, they want to like you, like, you know, it's not like a band. They didn't come there to not laugh. They came there to have a good time.
Right.
But also, it's really about how are you going to engage everyone in that room so that they can relate to you. Like, you know, like I remember a long time ago, like, you know, the thing about comedy, like if you go up on stage and act like you're a cool guy, you know, people in the audience are like, I'm not a cool guy. So I don't understand what this, you know, like, I don't get it. You know,
I'm sitting in a comedy club. I'm not cool. Like,
exactly. Yeah. So, you know, you kind of have to maneuver around that and figure out like what your vibe is going to be. Like I remember one time I did a show in Portland and these two women came up to me after the show and, you know, and they go, oh my God, when you came on stage, we didn't want to like you.
Right.
You know, like, and like, I'm such a people pleaser. I'm like, oh, I know. I get it. Thanks for coming. And then later on that night in my hotel, I was like, oh, wow, that's really a big, that's a big statement.
What's
like, and you know, they ended up liking the show, but what they were saying was, you know, the way, like the black t-shirt, the slick back hair, the fucking, you know, your whole vibe.
Mr.
We were
cool
like, oh my God, we're going to hate this guy.
Right.
And then once you started your act, and you're basically saying, yeah, I grew up with a head that was too big for my body. I didn't grow into my teeth until about 3 years ago. Hey, what's up? Then all of a sudden they're like, oh my God. Okay. Got it. You're one of us. We're one of you. Here we go.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. Cause I mean, you come to think of it, I'm going through like a list of comics I quite like in my head. And so many of them are pretty like, you know, either average, bordering on frumpy looking people. And it makes me think for myself, I've always imagined like if I have a very bland clothing style, you know, and part of the reason I always have was like if I take someone my size, my hair, my personality, which is big and sometimes obnoxious, and then I put them in like cool guy clothes and sort of over the top stuff, it's just going to be too much. Like it's too much for
the
world.
Way too much.
You know?
Way too much.
And you think that balance exists in comedy too, huh? Like. It makes sense.
I just think like, I think when you come out on, I think what it is this, is that everyone, you got to remember when you're on stage, everyone, first of all, the first thing I always think is that like, they want to like you, like they want to have that moment. But you also got to remember there's everyone in the audience thinks they're just as funny as you.
Right.
And Phyllis Diller had a great quote, you know, got quoting Phyllis Diller right now is like quoting Ben Franklin had a great quote. You know, at the Last Supper, Judas said something before he got out of there. No, it's like, you know, I'm quoting these old people, but there was this comedian, Phyllis Diller, legendary woman, super funny, legendary. And she said, when you're watching a comedian and you say to yourself, I could do that. You know what? You can't. That comedian is just so good that it makes you feel and believe that you can.
Right, right, right.
And what I really believe is that's the truth. You know, when I was growing up and I would watch comedians and you go, wow, man, I think I could do that. I don't know if you can. You might be able to try. But the thing is, George Carlin makes it so easy.
Right,
you know, yeah. Greg Girardo makes it so easy. Kyle Kinane makes it look so easy. And that's because they're so fucking great. That's where the magic. So my thing is that, you know, when I get up on, you know, when I get up on stage, my whole vibe is that I just want to have an experience with the audience where they walk out of the room saying, man, I laughed. I got what that guy said. And what I hope happens is that at the end of the set, they go, you know what? I left with a different perspective. And for me, you know, my perspective is going to be, you know, I'm a dad. I'm a father.
Right.
You know, I've been in the same relationship for 30 years. You know, I have a teenager. I have a teenage daughter. I'm basically in a relationship with three people that don't like me. You know, like I have to still put a smile on. You know, like that's right, you know, like right. You know, like those are that's my perspective and my own journey. And what I love, and I, you know, I've had this happen is when the end of the night, you know, I remember there's been times where I've been on some banging shows at the improv with banging comedians. I mean, I remember one night I had to follow Patton Oswalt, Sarah Silverman, and Whitney Cummings. I was the last one to go on because they all were like, I want to go on and get out of here.
Yeah.
But I remember going on, you know, with big lineups like that. And I remember one night a real, like, it's like almost the universe sent me a message was I was standing by the door after the show and everyone's coming by and, you know, you're, oh, thanks. Okay. You know, kind of, you know, shaking hands, whatever. And this one couple comes over to me and they go, we liked you the best. And I go, and it was on a lineup with like, just, you know, everyone on there, just like, okay, Conan O'Brien, this person was on Fallon. This person has a special. And I just, because this is the record guy in me, Benny and Brad, I go, can you tell me why?
Right. Yeah.
And I go, tell me why you liked me the best.
Give me
which
an
sounds weird.
Review here. Yeah.
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 And you know what they said? Because you talked about things that we understand and that we're going through.
Right.
Like you, and I remember at that point, the other comics are talking about, then I'm on this plane and I flew out and I'm sitting there with, you know, I'm sitting there with Scorsese and he says to me, you know, and they're like, dude, I'm not sitting with Scorsese,
so,
but
yeah,
what I do understand
become a little unattainable.
Yeah. But what I do understand is, why can't I feed my kids McDonald's anymore? And why is, you know, McDonald's a treat for me and a threat for my kids? Like, why is that? Like, how do my kids know about GMOs? You know, I didn't know, you know, that gluten isn't a metal band from Germany until recently. Like, I didn't know that. And those bits are the things that I feel connect with the audience that are into what I'm doing. And that was like, I remember that was a huge insight too. Okay. Then you know what? Like Richard Pryor used to always say, like, you know, he said, just whatever, you know, tell the truth because the truth will be funny.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, you try to write a joke and it's funny, but it's just not believable. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, dude,
right.
I know what you're talking. You know what? That didn't happen.
Yeah.
But right, when I right. tell a story, you know, when I tell a story about, you know, trying to help my son with, you know, math homework and not understanding it and getting upset and, you know, saying to him, like, you know, he's like, I need a tutor. And then I said, well, why don't you just cheat? Like, what happened to that? Doesn't anyone cheat anymore? No, we want to learn it. Why? You know, like those are real things I've said, you know, not proud of it, But the thing that I realized was, you know, you have to just be honest with really what's going on. And when you're honest and you find that funny in there, that's the stuff that's gold with the audience. Sure. 'Cause they'll come up afterwards and go, oh my God, when you said your daughter said, you know, like I used to tell this bit about my daughter when she was a teenager, like super, she was about 13 and I would drive her to school and I was so psyched. Like I got my daughter in the car and I got the, here we go, honey. And then she just looked at me and goes, Dad, I don't talk in a car. And I was like, what? And she's like, no, I don't talk in a car. And it was like a Dr. Seuss moment. Like, don't talk in a car. I won't talk when we go far. I do not talk in a hat. You know, like, dude, are you talking about? Yeah. And it was funny because I had all these people would come up to me and they go, oh my God, my daughter said the same thing or my son, you know, just like, you know, it's, yeah, you know, it's one of those things where it just connects. And that's my favorite part. And it's addicting, man. Yeah. It's like, I never have done any drugs in my entire life. And there's parts of me sometimes that I go, oh my God, I've been doing stand up for 11 years. And it's like now I understand when I, you know, when you hear about the guy, like that does the heroin and he goes to the really sketchy part of town, that's me going to tell jokes sometimes. Right, like, yeah. I'm going to go to La Brea in the sandwich shop that's sometimes a car repair. And at 8 o'clock, they set up chairs so I can tell some jokes to 8 people so I can get a laugh from them. And then I'm going to turn around and drive over to this place and tell jokes at, you know, at this club at 2. You know, it's like you're always trying to find that spot to do new material or tell jokes or try to tweak a word. And up until the pandemic, man, it's just so addicting, but you know, I didn't realize how much it took over my mind. Like, you know, like I've realized now just stand up. If you're really doing it, it'll seriously blur out everyone around you, your wife, your kids, your friends, because you're just always thinking about like that spot you have that night. And then you're like, how are you going to do these words? And you really have to be able to separate that from, you know, your other life, because it's so addicting and it's also, you want to get good at it. And then you just start, you know, and if you're going to get good, I mean, I guarantee you any comic like that we just mentioned, you know, all those guys that I mentioned, all those women I mentioned, it's like all of them, they would definitely say, yeah, it's an obsessive thing that just controls your, right. your mind, because you have to. It's not like music where we can like, you know, all three of us could jam together and we go, okay, cool. That sounded good. Work on your part. I'll work on mine. And then Friday night's the gig. Like, and we would be good. You know what I'm saying? We would be good.
Good enough.
But stand up, it's not like that. You have to have a crowd. You have to have an audience. Yeah. And, you know, I didn't realize that until this pandemic happened, you know, with, wow, how, you know, like not having the audience and not having that interaction is just, it's strange. And, you know, and honestly, I don't know if we ever will, you know, I don't know. I mean, I've been doing outside shows. Yeah. I did a show at a drive-in. You know, I feel like that's a Band-Aid though, sure. for where we're going.
But that brings in something I wanted to talk about with you. 'Cause I don't get it. I love comedy. It's like been a huge part of my life from when I was a kid until now. I'm always seeking out new comics and albums, and I've always felt there was something about my internal conflict and struggle that made me relate, not just to these people, but to the stories they were telling. And you talk about how it kind of becomes obsessive and takes over, and you start. The thing I wonder is, you know, I've heard countless times that great comics are sort of like deep sociologists who need to recognize, you know, like the pain and struggle of people in a very intimate way, and therefore suffer themselves as a result. Like, do you think that's true? Have you seen that? And do you find yourself going down some of those wormholes where you sort of need to constantly reflect so much on the things that are awkward or painful or strange for people to be able to, deliver that to like an audience?
I mean, I would say this, like to answer, like it's a threefolded question that you're asking. And I would say, have I met people that are extremely funny on stage and extremely, they have a persona on stage and that persona is not the persona off of stage? Absolutely. You know, I've met comics that seem so full of life and just energy. And when they're on stage, they're in their happy place. And then as soon as they get off stage, they can't even call an Uber to come get them. They can't even balance a checkbook. They're so just, that is everything that they live for. And if they don't have people helping them, then you're like, wow, that's a scary moment. Then I also have comics that will go out and just crush and just be so funny. And when they get off stage, they're so still, asking people around them or asking you, was that funny?
Right,
like
right.
I've had comedians that have multiple specials and they've had multiple just accolades and things in their life. And you know, they're a real comic because when they walk backstage, there's this moment when you're waiting or you're sitting in the room or you're where they are. And they have this look in their eye for, and even though they crushed it, they have this look at their eye where they make eye contact with you. And the look says, was that funny?
Right.
Was that funny? Dad, mom, right. Dad, did you see me? There's the little boy, mom, was I funny? Yeah. Mom, can you get off the phone? Mom, dad, did you see me score the goal? And it's this weird moment. And so with bigger comics, it's a second. And with other, you know, maybe other comics, it lasts longer. And maybe it's the car ride home and it's the talking and back and forth. But like, you know, that's when you know, like you're a comic, has that moment where they just want to know, are they funny? Like I remember Jim Brewer, you know, told this crazy story about, I'm spacing on his name right now. The guy that was on Saturday Night Live, the big dude that put the little tiny jacket on.
Chris Farley.
Yeah. So Jim Burr told me this story and he's talked about it before, but you know, Chris Farley came to do the show and Jim Brewer, who, you know, I've got to open with for the last, you know, 2 years and just became really good friends with. And he's such a spiritual dude, Brewer, and just really cool. But he told me this story once and in short, it was Chris Farley was on the show and they're the Saturday Night Live and they're writing these skits and they're doing this and they're doing that. And Chris, it was when Jim and Chris did the El Nino thing.
Oh yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, weatherman. And he's like, I'm El Nino. And like, it was just, it was legendary. Yeah, right. So but they were doing they were working out the bits. And, at this point, you know, Jim's family man, he's living in the suburbs, driving into the city or, you know, whatever. And I think he might've had his first kid and you know, he says that he gets the phone call and he's like, it's like, you know, it's him on the phone. He's like, Jimmy, how are you? And he's like, yeah, you know, and they're going back and forth. And he's like, come out tonight with me. And he's like, nah, Chris, you know, I'm staying. He's like, nah, come on. You know, I really want you to hang out. Like, I'm in town. Let's hang out. And it's late. And like, Jim's like, Chris, dude, you know, I'm not going. And then right before he hangs up the phone, he says to Jim, he goes, Jim, am I funny?
Oh, man.
And like, you know, it was just so sad and just like, wow. Like he's asking to, hey, come and hang out with me. Okay. You're not going to do that. But can I ask you one question? Am I funny?
Yeah. Wow.
And like, I remember when he told me that story, I was like that always hit a core with me because Chris Farley, who you and I and everyone we love. Yeah, I mean, dude, the movies, yeah, the bits, sure. the physical comedy. I mean, and he's still, even he is asking a fellow comedian, hey, am I funny? And it's not like, you know, at this point, I think he's a guest on the show. He's not even on the show. Right. You know what I'm saying? He's like guest. And, that always stuck with me. So like, that's like the one question. And then the second thing is that, you know, for me going down the wormholes is, you know, I think, well, I always joke around, you know, like, you know, you're a comedian when the first time another comedian gets to do something that you didn't and you go, I'm fucking funnier than them. Oh, you know, right, you see, sure, yeah. And you go, and I remember the first time I did that, like, what the fuck, man? I can't. And I go, oh my gosh. Oh my God. I do not want to be that guy. Yeah, right, oh my, right, like, right. Did I just say, did I just say I'm funnier? Oh, and I, right then I remember, you know, going, I am not playing that game because you don't win in that game and you never sound cool and you become bitter and you just, it's over. It happens in music. Yeah. It happens in sports. It happens in everything. So dude, get over yourself, put your head down and work fucking hard.
Yeah, I'm sure you've seen plenty of cautionary tales in music.
Totally.
That kind of
mindset. Dude, but I remember playing music and getting pissed. Why do they get that? Oh, why did they get to do that? And not knowing, dude, you know, like, you know, even Louis C.K. Yeah. Louis C.K. wrote a great thing once And it was just a piece that he wrote where he said, just worry about yourself. Quit worrying about other people. Just work hard and just do what you need to do and quit worrying about everyone else around you. And I remember I was like, you know what? I'm taking that to heart. I'm just going to work on my shit and just do what I got to do. And hopefully, you know, what I do connects and people will be into it. That was a big lesson. So that's the second part of your question. You know, when do you kind of know like, okay, I'm in it. I'm in it for life is when I think you have those moments.
Okay.
And the last thing I would say is that like for me, you know, with my comedy, it personally, like, you know, like I think I talk a lot about my relationships with my kids and I talk a lot about relationship, you know, that I'm in, you know, with Karen, my wife. And some of it's good and some of it is, you know, some of it isn't good.
Right.
And I think the stuff that makes people laugh the hardest sometimes is the stuff that's not good.
Right.
And, you know, that's the stuff that someone will say to you, you know, did that really happen? And when you say, yeah, it did, they laugh. But like when it was really happening in reality, it wasn't funny. It wasn't funny. It wasn't funny. You know, it wasn't funny when that moment happened, but you know what? The only way I can get through it is to make a joke about it. Like that's always been, I think, the way I've gotten through super hard times. Like even right now during the pandemic, you know, I can make jokes about it, but like, you know, it's a weird time because it's also like, I can't joke about not knowing how we go into the next, you know, level of our lives, you know, and like right now with anxiety and you're hearing, you know, just so many stories about, you know, people going through, you know, that have never experienced depression and anxiety. Like to me, that's the hardest thing to hear people going through right now. And it's, and then as a comedian, you know, some people are like, well, you got to still make them laugh, you know? But then like, you're like, dude, I don't know.
Yeah,
like I don't time? Like, it feels trivia.
Sure.
You know? Yeah, exactly. You know, you're like, yeah, you know, I want to make people laugh, but I also want to be respectful. I you know, I'm not going to just put my head down and be like, everything's great. You know, I'm also not going to be like, everything sucks, because the only way I can get up in the morning is that if I do believe in humanity and positive energy and that we are going to get through this, because if not, man, then I don't have any reason to get out of bed. So, you know, it kind of all plays into that psyche that I think you said that you love about certain comedians.
Right. Yeah. It's almost like a self-fulfilling thing at some point where, I mean, I've even seen musicians do it too. People who create conflict in their lives essentially to have more to write about. It's not conscious. You know what I mean? It's very subconscious. And I don't think people would do it on purpose, but you know, sometimes you need to reach to certain depths that are not fun.
You know what? I've said this to artists on the label, and like you guys are a prime example of like when I worked with, you know, when we all worked together with Gaslight. Mm-hmm. The reason Gaslight was one of the reasons, you know, besides, you know, the four of you made this amazing sound. You had Brian with these lyrics and this vocal that was just like, okay, what the hell's going on? Right. Then you had Alex with this guitar that I always said was like a paintbrush.
Yeah,
it's like beautiful. He was just painting these lines that you were nowhere. And then you had, you know, you and the other Alex, you know, laying down this foundation that was like brick and mortar, just like marble, just like old school, just like, wow. You know, like when you go to an old house and you're like, dude, this house ain't going to fall apart, bro. This is solid. Like it was the two of you. And then you had these two just flowing energies, lyrical, painting pictures with words, and then this guitar that would, you know, just paint another color. It was just a perfect match. But the other thing was, and this is just my honest opinion, was there was no backup plan for Gaslight. If that band didn't make it, you guys were going to be painting walls, hanging sheetrock, doing construction, Maybe, you know, just digging holes. There was no fucking backup plan. There was no, well, you know, Brian's valedictorian and he has a degree. Okay. No, that's not the case. Well, you know, Benny, you know, he can always go back to playing baseball for, that's not the case. Well, you know, Alex, nothing's going on there. Like there was like, if this band does not make it, then we are fucked.
Yeah.
And I remember that was the same thing with Flogging Molly.
Right.
It was the same thing with Gogo Bordello. It was the same thing with the Casual. Any band that I really believe went to the depths that you guys went to. I mean, even I remember like on that first record, you know, you guys dug deep. And I feel like as artists, that's where the great art comes from, because any of the bands that we love, whether it's the Ramones, whether it's Sinatra, whether it's the Beatles, I mean, any of these bands that we love, they all were in that place at one point.
Yeah.
When the Beatles, you know, were doing the residency and they're sleeping, you know, four in the same room and they're doing the three sets, the 10,000 hours that we all read about. Dude, that is fucking, if we don't make it, we're fucked.
Right.
Like there's a time where they're like, dude, you know, like you remember Ringo? He was like, yeah, I'm going to be in this band for a while and then I'm going to go back to cutting hair. Like
right.
they didn't, yeah. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, even the Stones, when they asked Charlie to join the band, they were like, yeah, he'll just join. He's such a great drummer. He'll just jam with us for a little while and then it's going to be over. Like, so like what I love is when bands are at that place in their life that they're in the ocean, dude. And there's no lifeguard, all right. And all they're seeing is shark fins and big waves, and they're still got a smile on their face. And they're like, you know, no, we're gonna make this happen.
Yeah.
And that's where I feel with comedians, with artists, with any type of entertainment. I hate to say it, but I feel the best comes out of you when you're just holding on by a thread. Mm. And I feel like that's where the great art comes from. And that's one of the things that I really think made Gaslight, at least in my opinion, when I was with you guys. I mean, the first time I see you guys, San Diego, you know, we're loading gear in and out. We're hanging in the van. I'm like, wow, okay, this is it. When I was in Wax, dude, right. It was the same thing.
Yeah.
We were done. If Scott Whelan hadn't have played the song, we were done deal.
Yeah,
life or death.
Got to be all in. You got to be all in case that thing comes your way, right?
I really believe you got to be all in. I think anything in your life, I think whenever you're in and you're out and you're like, well, if this doesn't work out, you know, I'll always do this. That's telling the universe you really don't want it. You're not cut out for it.
Yeah.
And the universe is like, hey, check it out. This is just my opinion. I think the universe, when you throw it out to that thing, the universe says, hey, check it out. Like I can't give you you're giving me one foot in, one foot out where there's another kid that he's got both feet in, yeah, both arms exactly. in. So I'm going with him.
And even beyond philosophically, I mean, it's just numbers. It's like there are thousands and thousands of people trying to do exactly what you're trying to do and working really hard. And
there's a lot of people that are better.
Exactly. And they're better. And you have to at least put in maximum effort.
I mean, how many people do you know? Like I look back on my life and I can straight up say like I was not a great singer. I am not like some singer, like Eddie Vedder. He's a great singer. You know, Chris Cornell, he's a great singer. I was not a great singer, but I have had a career in music because I worked hard and I had life or death. And it was like, if this isn't going to happen, then I'm fucked.
And great like, fucking hair, Joe.
And great hair, you know, now that's one of the things I can't control. But I would say the same thing goes with any great band, you know, I mean, there, you know, as well as I know, it's like, are there bands that existed that are better than Gaslight Anthem? Yeah, sure. Probably. Yeah. And you know what? They didn't put in the time. They didn't put in the effort. They didn't put in the hard work. And instead, you know, they went, oh yeah, kind of this, kind of that. I mean, dude, how many drummers do you know? And how many guitar players, Brad, do you know that just ripped so hard? And you're like, why that guy is like, you know, we all have the guy that we all remember right, as a kid. He was the guy. Yeah. Like, why isn't he huge?
Survivor's you know? Guilt.
Yeah.
I remember as a kid, my dad and when I was living with my dad, I was in my first band. And I remember there was a guy across the street from me, and he was a ripping guitar player, and he's just a great guy. And his, like, my dad and him started talking at one point, and the guy kind of insinuated, oh, well, Joe's just in a punk band, and you know, it doesn't matter that he's doing shows. You know, my son's this, my son's that. And my dad fucking said it without anything. My son ain't playing in his bedroom. My son's doing shows. And I remember I was like, fuck, but it hit home. Yeah, like, yeah, I'm not that good, but you know what? I'm hanging it out. I'm not sitting in my bedroom playing the records. Yeah. I'm playing my own jams. My jams aren't good. I'm singing not well, but you know what? We sold fucking, a keg of beer, you know, 40 cups at $2 a piece. And here we go. It's on, you know? And that was like I remember when my dad said that, and that was like, wow. Maybe I am doing it. You know,
it's one of the things that's always endeared me to you, Joe, is like you meet you and there's, you know, kind of an East Coast hustler spirit about you where you're always trying to get something done. And then there's like kind of this restless spirit in you that's always looking for what's next and not satisfied with the thing that's happening. And I appreciate it. And I think it's what makes you, you. I appreciate you, Joe. Well,
I appreciate you saying that.
And thanks for coming on our program. How nice.
Dude, thank you guys, man. I hope, I have to say this. I hope the people that listen to the program, like, I hope you're not all like, God, like, I hope I didn't talk too much, no. I hope I did okay.
If you didn't talk too much, I would have talked too much, and then Brad would have reprimanded me later.
Oh my God, I didn't even, I could do another whole like hour.
Wow.
I got a lot more questions. I didn't even get in the Ramon story, which I wanted. So, you know.
We didn't even get to talk about, you know, one of the things I got to say was that last run, was that two summers ago when you guys had me come out to open for you?
Yeah, in 18. Yeah.
Oh my God. That was so much fun. I'll never forget the last show we did, at the Riviera. Yeah. Oh my God. I remember that night because I always wanted to play the Riviera and, you know, first of all, you know, you guys gave me a spot on your bus. So like, we're hanging out. We're, you know, it's just like from the moment I got there, like we're just joking around family. Constantly. Yeah. It was so much fun. But, I remember when Brian asked me, he's like, hey man, you know, we're going to do this and we're having different openers and we want you to come out. And I had already opened for a few bands. Like I'd opened for Bad Religion and didn't go well. Right, opened for Angels and Airwave, didn't go well. But like I knew, I remember I opened up, God, I'm spacing on the name of the band. It'll come to me in a second. But I opened up for a band in New York and it went really well. And the reason it went well was when they asked me, I said, hey, I'll do this, but you guys have to tell your audience that a comedian is opening the show or I can't do it. Yeah. And they were like, got it. So when I showed up that night, everyone was like, yeah, we're not starting circle pits. This guy's coming out. He's going to tell some jokes. Now, granted, you still got to be fucking funny. Sure. But I remember I said to Brian, and I remember when he called me, it was like the beginning of the year. And you know, it's like, he's all fresh. And I go, hey man, he's like, dude, we want to do this thing. What do you, I'm like, oh my God, really? He goes, yeah, we want you to come out. And I go, okay. I go, hey, can I ask you one thing? He's like, yeah, anything. And I go, so the way it'll work, you got to come out every night and you got to introduce me. He's like, oh, dude, no problem. That's not even an issue. And I go, I remember in my head, I'm like, you're sure? Like you have to come out and you got to go, hey, everyone, you know, this first guy coming up, he's a buddy of ours. You know, he signed our band and he's our good, funny friend, Joseph. You know, like, and I said, Brian, after that, it's up to me. I got to get a laugh because that's the big thing with comedy. You got to get a laugh. Like the sooner you get a laugh, it's the sooner the audience trusts you. And then I always say to people, like you have a bank account with the audience. And the more laughs you fill it up with, the more they trust you to go on a longer journey. So I remember though, I come out. Now you guys have already been on the road for a little while. So when I show up, you know, Brian's, you know, like he's been singing, he's trying to conserve his energy, his voice, da da. And then all of a sudden he goes, I remind him, I'm like, hey dude, tonight, you remember you gotta go out. And this is when I knew him and I were friends because anyone else, you know, you're going to be like, yeah, dude, I'm not going to be able to do that. Right. And I remember he goes, really? And he did that Brian Fallon, you know, where he takes his hat off and runs his hand through his fucking hair, like, oh shit. And then I remember the first night he goes out and he does it. The second night he goes out and he does it. I remember on the third night he says to me, why did I agree to this? You know, like, because Brian's actually opening, you know, at that point. And I'm like, yeah, dude. And if he hadn't have done that, oh my God, it you know, but the I'll just never forget that show at the Riviera, man. It was so packed. And that was one. I have a photo from that night, and that was one. I still get people that text me. I saw you at the Ruby. Like, they'll come to see me in Chicago, and they literally came to see me at that show. And now, whenever I come through doing comedy, they're like, first night we ever saw you is you opened up for Gaslight. We didn't know who you were. You went on.
I love that.
Yeah. But thank you guys for having me, Brad, you know, Benny.
Thanks for coming on, man. I really appreciate it.
Dude, I loved it.
Yeah, dude.
Thank you guys for having me.
Long overdue.
All right. See you, Joe. Thanks.
Be safe, you guys. Thanks, you guys. Later, Brad.
I know how to clap. I can clap loud. I got really big hands. I don't know if you know that about me. Wait, let me say that differently.
Yeah. Why'd you wink at me when you said that, Benny?
I don't know if you know something about me, Brad. Got very large hands. I got a pretty deep voice. It's funny. I thought I had a high voice forever, and I used to go into the studio and try to sing, and it always sounded really bad. And I eventually just gave up on singing. And then, like, somewhere in like my early 30s, I was like, I'm like, oh, what the fuck?
You got some range.
I've hung out with all these singers all these years, and no one told me I should try a little lower, because that's just where it's more natural. I got laughed out of a studio when I was like 16, and it just permanently scarred me from singing.
And you never went back.
I was in a band called Full Circle Swing, and we were recording our 7-inch, and we were all doing backups. And this group of people happened to be, they're from a town in an area in Jersey called Woodbridge. They were kind of just like classic Jersey hip hop skateboard shit talking kids. Right. Like, they were brutal, you know? And you couldn't get away with anything with these guys. You just got ripped apart. It was the spirit of the group, you know?
Right.
And I didn't hate it. You know, I had fun with it myself. But I go into the studio. The line was sun on my face. And I try it once. And I did it like super soul man. I was like, son on my first. Like, you know, like white boy soul, like Bob Seger or something, you know? Right. And I just see the entire room burst out laughing, just going insane and just like, you know, deaf comedy jam, knee slap laughing. And I'm just like, oh, fuck this. I'm done. Like, I'll never do this again in my life. Like, sit in a room and do it by myself. And Benny, it's pretty much true.
That's terrible.
I've done a lot of backups. You know, I'm a backup singer on a lot of records. I used to keep a mic for Gaslight shows, but I would just hit it probably more than I sang in it.
Right.
And what I sang in it wasn't good enough to keep hitting it. So I was just like, ah, fuck it. Like, I'm going to stop. And then that was it. I just went the way of straight drummer.
Well, maybe, you know, it's time you develop those vocal cords again, dude.
Well, I do have it. So it hasn't came out in a while because I'm not the man I used to be. But I did have a cheap whiskey drunk alter ego named Blind Benny who sang very, very sexual blues songs.
Really?
Yeah. Very deep lyrics in the spirit of, you know, Teddy Pendergrass. Like, I'm talking hot oils and sex and loving.
Can I hear it?
I mean, no, you can't. But if, yeah, I mean, for I real, to, if you,
it's only
if
for we lovers.
If we get a handle of early times and we just have a good feeling night and you put a mic, like, you might get a whole album, man. So, yeah, I mean, it is possible. This, let's just say, this person lives inside of me.
Okay.
You know what I mean? There's somebody who looks like Teddy Pendergrass who lives inside
of me. Wow.
Yeah.
I gotta meet this guy.
Is this tickling your mind too? You're like, wow, Benny is probably a fantastic lover. You're right, Brad. You're right. I'm very good. No. Sure. But that was a great interview with Joe. I bet Joe's a good lover.
Of course he is.
I would imagine he is.
Us little guys are all good. You don't know that?
No, I don't. Is that a thing?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, you work harder?
Yeah.
And then I feel like that flipped on its ear, that could be a very, very bad negative stereotype. Let's stay away from that. But that was an awesome interview. I learned so much that I didn't know. That thing with Stone Temple Pilots and Scott Whelan playing the Wax song all on K-Rock all night.
Yeah, I didn't know that either, dude.
I didn't hear about that.
I mean, I met him when he was in 22 Jacks. I knew Wax. I mean, I knew the band, but I didn't know any of his real history, really, with Wax. I would still like to talk to him about it. There's a lot there. He's got stories.
Stories on stories. That was awesome for him to come on. And everybody should definitely check out his comedy if you haven't. It's getting better and better the longer he goes. He's got some really funny bits. There's some good stuff up on YouTube, some full bits. And you should definitely try it. He did those shows with Jim Brewer, opening for Metallica.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, shit's funny, man. He's like... It's turned in from, you know, like he was explaining in the podcast, just watching someone go from just being a storyteller to a, you know, it's like that thing where people probably all think they can do it. And it's so fucking hard.
It's a good quote.
Even when he's like, oh, I went up and I had to do 7 minutes. I'm like, the idea of like, that sounds terrifying.
Yeah. That's
just being on a microphone, trying to make people laugh for 7 minutes. It feels like an eternity.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's awesome, man. And he knows Pauly Shore. You know, he was literally in Biodome. He was in Biodome and Mallrats. Like, Joe is like the king of the 90s. It's too fucking funny, man. But it was awesome. And then, you know, my first impression of Joe was cool because, you know, they came to see us in San Diego. You know, the other guy from Side One had come the night before in LA.
Right.
He had come to San Diego, and we played an awful fucking show. It was like, seriously, one of the worst like we could have ever played. It was just a bad venue, bad night. Nothing shook out right. And one of the things that immediately stood out to me about Joe was he was there. Of course, I knew who he was. My brother was like a giant Wax fan. So like, you know, I even had element going into it. Yeah. And Joe is like talking to me. And he's helping me carry out my drums. And then he's still talking to me and he's helping me break down my drums. And I just got the impression in the moment, I'm like, this guy's not like trying to show up to me. Like, he doesn't even know he's doing it. Right. He's just like, he's like just talking and just into it. And he's just helping because he is.
Yeah, because he's been in bands.
I was like, I don't know. That was one of those things when I first met him. I'm like, to me, that's impressive. Like, I like that. And then I remember when we first went to their office, we were taking a lot of meetings in those days. And, you know, they were really starting to get like pretty fucking corny. And some of the shit people were like saying and presenting to us was really fucking corny, really the wrong pitch. And we show up to the Side One office and it's just like, bros, you know, and it's like just a tray of tacos. It's just chilling. There's like, you know, people from other bands just working there, and it's had this whole vibe that was just so different. It felt so like surfer punk rock California that it was just like, you know what, this doesn't feel like that big of a label. And they got a bunch of money because of fucking Flogging Molly and Warped Tour comps and like all this shit. I'm like, this might be the best of both worlds here, because like it feels real good and they got just as much as everyone else, so fuck it, like this seems cool.
Yeah,
you know. And it was like, it was one of those impulses that was really easy to make, but just his whole spirit and the way he goes about things was very welcoming, even from the start, you know?
Yeah, he's an honest guy, and you can tell, you know? Like, yeah, he'll carry your drums without doing it for a reason.
Right.
That's a funny story, because Howie Klein, who was the president of Reprise Records,
right,
when we signed to him, did the same thing.
Oh,
came to his show. We played in L.A., the Troubadour. And he made a point of like carrying, like trying to carry an amp upstairs, maybe he carried a guitar case. And I think he was genuine, but I also think like he knew what he was doing, you know. It wasn't I can see Joe doing it. I can see what you're talking about. Like, he wouldn't know any better. It would be instinct.
I'm telling you, he didn't even know.
It was instinct for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because he'd done it a million times, dude.
Right.
I mean, he went from Wax to 22 Jacks, you know, like 22 Jacks was a great band, but, you know, they were in Vans, man, you know, like.
Well, listen, but let's not sit here and pretend like every singer of a band is helping to break down drums.
Right.
That's about maybe
that's a good
5% to 10% of singer has ever touched a drum stand in their life.
That's a good
point.
So
it even goes a step beyond that, you know. I know a lot of punk rock singers who've never touched a fucking drum either.
That's a very good point. So any of you singers out there.
Yeah, there's about three of you I've seen be cool.
Turn it around.
No, it's cool. Just carry your mic and drink more throat coat. You're fucking fine.
And go scare all the girls away before we can get our shit loaded in the van.
Go hang out with the merch guy, whatever you're doing. But Joe's around. He's just Joe Sib on Twitter, Joe_Sib on Instagram. He's got all of his comedy stuff on YouTube. He's doing the those little 15-minute segments through the Side One site that I think I'm going to be doing soon too.
Oh, nice!
Yeah, so he's got a lot going on as usual, and everyone should check him out.
Absolutely.
And guess what, Brad? We have a Patreon.
Oh yeah, do we? Patreon.com/goingofftrack.
Yeah, there's stuff on it. I wrote some stuff. You've been posting some stuff. Yeah,
we got some more stuff I need to get up.
Exclusive video. Maybe you can see video of this with me creepy in the dark. But yeah, appreciate it. If anyone wants to help us out, keep it going. That's nice. And thanks to everyone who jumped on. I saw Heath Saraceno's on.
Yeah.
Heath is awesome. Appreciate that, man. And I'll never forget your brother hooking me up with mozzarella wedges at the TGA Fridays in the Somerville Circle. Appreciate that. Good looks. And yeah, I don't know, man. I appreciate anyone helping us out. We want to do this for a long time, and we want to make it sound good and get cool guests. That's another thing on the Patreon. If anyone's got, like, someone, a guest that they've been like, I would love to hear those guys talk to him. Write me a message because I'm curious. Like, who's someone like you would want us to talk to?
You know?
I'm always saying, I told you, I'm starting to view booking Going Off Track like a mixtape, you know?
Yeah, well, it is a mixtape, dude.
Like, and now we had Tim from Rise Against and Joe Sib, some big heavy hitter singers. We got to, like, break it up a little bit next week. Be a little cool, you know? You got heavy hitter,
maybe
heavy hitter vocalist. We had Tom Wally stories 2 weeks in a row. We got to go deep.
All right. Maybe a drummer.
No, then no one will listen. We'll find someone. Unless you could score Tommy Lee or something. That's an episode that'll go in the gutter. Who wants to hear us? You know? Unless you killed someone or something.
No. All right.
Hey, how did you construct your drum parts on this record? Click. No thanks. All of a sudden, this episode, you'd be like, why did everyone click off 8 minutes into that episode? Weird, you know?
It was only 10 minutes long.
Yeah, exactly. Listen, I've been in the business long enough. I know. I've looked in the face of too many label executives who saw me as just
another drummer.
Replaceable part, man. I know it. I know it. I know it for sure. They're like, yeah, nice to meet you. You're not important to me.
All right.
Just listen, kids. Drums are great. They're a beautiful instrument. They're great for your soul. But there's two things that are going to happen that you're going to have to get used to, okay? If you take it seriously. Something on your body is going to break and hurt really bad. Either a wrist, a lower back, a neck, an elbow, something like that. And you got to get used to getting no credit for your life's work. You know, just that little simple pill to swallow.
Easy. I don't know about that. It's
easy.
You're in an elite group of drummers who can actually play the instrument.
I need to talk to you and Joe Sibmore. You two make me feel good. I'm going to get on side calls with you guys. Be like, hey, guys, you just stroke my ego a little for a couple minutes. Big Daddy needs it to get through today, you know?
Anytime, Benny. Anytime you need strokes, just let me know.
I know you're good. You're good. Got a couple more Sierra Nevadas in you.
I'm going to go get another one. This one's empty.
All right. Do your thing. But everybody, thank you for coming and visiting Going Off Track this week. And yeah, we'll be back soon. You got anything to leave the people with, Brad?
Much love. Stay safe.
No bed of roses.
No pleasure cruise. I consider it a challenge, my love.
The whole human race.
What is it?
That's your note. That's your note.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.